This episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Universal Studios' Halloween Horror Nights in Hollywood. Immerse yourself in a living, breathing, three-dimensional world of terror. Now through Saturday, November 5th. Visit them online at halloweenhorrornights.com/Hollywood to learn more about the event and buy tickets.
Okay, and welcome to episode 23 of Shockwaves, our special Halloween episode. Spooky. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. Sitting with me is Mr. Elric Kane, drinking good beer.
I'm the only one here who isn't sick.
That's right.
You guys disgust me.
We all have our teas in front of us.
Your weird society-like sex parties at Blumhouse. And I show up. Mid-shunting with Becca, God knows where.
Yes. I have the theory that you are like the outbreak monkey, where you infect,
you don't get it, but you infect everyone.
All of us.
So, terrible theory.
You're it. But anyway, also, Rebecca McKendry, welcome.
Hi, Rebecca Contagious McKendry.
I'm a little raspy today, but I'm doing good.
And Mr. Ryan Turek.
Ryan Rotten Turek.
What? The rotten? Is the
rotten? Because I'm
literally,
rotten.
No, rotten as in I am literally rotting inside due to the sickness.
Oh, Ryan Rotting.
I don't know what the other reference is, but.
Yeah, you barred us from that nickname.
Yeah.
But Ryan Ron is dead, but never in my heart. Right.
But he's still rotten.
but not online.
So welcome. So yeah, this will air right before Halloween. We have a great guest later, and we're going to be talking. We're going to try to tackle a topic again. It's been a long time since we've weaved a topic into our interview, so we're going to be talking haunted houses.
Yeah, this one's sponsored by Universal's Halloween Horror Nights Hollywood. So we wanted to do a theme, so we went haunted houses. It's fitting.
Yeah, and before anything, since last episode, because Ryan mentioned it, I've seen a lot of new comments on the iTunes page.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much. Please continue to rate, review us on iTunes and subscribe wherever you can.
It just helps spread the word.
Yeah, we appreciate it. And
boost the ratings on the iTunes page.
And if you subscribe, because I don't know if you'll listen to the end of this episode, look at your feed on Sunday morning and you might get an extra little treat, courtesy of Shockwaves.
A little Halloween treat, you say, Rob?
Maybe. You'll see.
A little morsel of candy corn.
Goodness,
in
some
your
good
bag.
Stuff there. So just wait.
In your little ear canal?
So
candy corn in your ear canal.
You know what I also think?
They would fit pretty snug.
You could probably hear in our voices, but we're all dying.
Yeah. Last year, I was listening back to last week's episode, and I was like this.
By the end of October, the elements have gotten us. We have been beaten down, and I don't know. Just feeling
kind of out of it. A lot of film festivals, a lot of stuff going on.
I just want to say I feel great. Thanks, guys.
I have to say now, Elric.
He's super dad because he's got two kids and a life. And
he is sitting so like far away from any of us.
I'm hanging out with the sound guy who also is a healthy man.
Shout out to Ernie. By the way, Ernie's been with us for quite a couple episodes now. So shout out to Ernie Hurtado for recording us and doing a stellar job.
Thank you.
We have yet to do that. But let's dive right in. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. Cool. I wanted to immediately start with TV stuff. Exorcist. No spoilers, obviously.
God, it's going to be a hard week without spoilers.
My God, it was such a good week.
I know, but we could do it. We could do it because we want people to tune in and watch the show. There's a two-week break now, so this is the ideal.
Oh, my God, I can't leave this for 2 weeks. They've just opened a whole can.
I think it's the World Series, right?
Yeah, they opened. They ended the last episode pretty much by dropping. Like, look, this is 5 episodes in. And they have introduced something that immediately changes the dynamic, at least the context of the episodes previous and the trajectory of what the remaining 5 will be. Mm-hmm. I think it's awesome. Mostly across the board, the response has been positive to how the show's been growing and how they implemented this. I've only heard from a few people that think it was a quote-unquote cheap trick. I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah.
I thought it was really smart.
Yeah, to have a cheap trick would have to be unplanned. Yeah. They probably built the whole series around this.
Oh,
place,
yeah. And,
so
and that's the thing is you could tell because now I look at some of the choices made in the earlier episodes by Gina Davis, and I'm like, oh, that totally adds up. And so
now whether it'll be whether it'll work is a whole it's out of our control. Yeah, we don't know till the next episode.
Well, that's what I say. Up to this point, they have earned it. Yeah. Like started with this and been like, okay, this is the premise. We're rolling with it from the beginning. But the fact that they built five really fucking good episodes and then dropped it, you earned it.
Yeah.
I think so.
I think our text conversation said it all.
Yeah, yeah. Our text conversation said it all. Well, it's funny because there were two series that did big reveals. One was American Horror Story, Roanoke, and then The Exorcist. it was really funny because it's interesting to see when horror kind of goes inside baseball and starts to ask the audience to get behind characters who are, quote unquote, within the industry.
Yeah.
You know, like writers, producers, directors, hey, you know, fast talkers. And American Horror Story did just that this week.
Yeah.
And so what they did, and you guys, I mean, like if it's online, the promos are all over the place. You've seen the kind of switch up, but they ended the kind of Roanoke story arc that they had begun with as you're watching a TV, like a documentary, and then you're now behind the scenes. And
as
you're
going
back
to the woods.
Yeah, you meet the producer who produced the first season of American Horror, you know, of the Roanoke series. And they're being asked to go back and do a new show. So you now meet a producer. You meet multiple producers. You now meet the cast, you know, who did the reenactments. And it was just really funny because I thought it was funny. You know, I was like, oh, good. We're going to see some stereotypes like send up, you know, and you're going to see, you know, broad personalities and you're going to see some nice jabs at the industry. But my girlfriend, you know, she was just like, I'm so tuned out now.
Yeah, David hated it.
I was super invested in the play they had of, you know, a true life versus a reenactment and how it would culminate. And she was just like, I'm out. Like, I don't know what else to do. I'm like disconnected emotionally. Meanwhile, I was kind of like, I love this. This is great.
There's a scene where the trucks pull up and they're like, where do we set up craft services? Yeah, and they're like, get the out of here. We can't. We're breaking realism. And so for me, it was a really interesting kind of lifting of the curtain.
Yeah.
Fictionalized. Yeah. Yeah. But
who doesn't? That for me, I was totally out too because I've seen that a million times. I've seen the lifting of the. This is, I've seen the player. I've seen movies.
Right. Yeah.
So it is fun. I agree with you. Yeah. I actually enjoyed seeing the switch, but then I was like, I don't think I could stick with this show for very long.
Well, I'm curious to see where the two, because it's like
I heard it had another big shift coming.
There's like a big I heard there's
five
a big,
episodes
exactly.
from here. It does another U-turn.
There's going to be another big U-turn, and I'm just curious to see where it's all culminating to. But I think this is the most focused American Horror Story since season one.
It seems pretty well planned. It does feel like it all connects.
It's very consistent. You know?
I love Kathy Bates. I loved her as an actress on the show in her character of the butcher, and now that they're showing her as like
a maniac actress.
Yeah, a maniac actress. I love her.
The show starts becoming less of a show that I want to watch for like the actual story and just a, hey, let's see what these crazy actors are doing this year. And because it's the it's like a traveling band that reinvents themselves every year, which is cool, but it's not why, like, you know, the other show I got introduced this week, you know, you guys are already talking about it, from Dick set me down to watch the Channel Zero,
which is awesome,
and it totally blew my mind. I was like, I didn't even know, you know, people would do this on TV, especially the Sci-Fi Channel. It's shot so well, it feels like this American independent film that goes for a lot, but then the kids stuff is so good, and I always love that term, kinder trauma, but this is the ultimate. I mean, this is literally about kinder trauma, and it's also dealing with
fucking,
you know, these little, you know, these characters, these puppets and stuff. So I'm all in. I watched the third episode last night, and it wasn't quite as good as the other two because they tried to put in a lot more story, but then it ended so well that I'm like, all right, this is a really unique show, and I can't. I'm so excited to see what the whole thing is. And then the next one is going to be a whole new thing. And where I think American Horror Story could benefit is not by always bringing back the same people. I know it's hard for them because they've got this great group of people, but I do think there's something about our imaginations that get lost when we don't recognize everyone every time.
So here's my theory on, you know, why American Horror Story's success is what it is when it comes to audiences kind of overlooking the anthological segment of it, you know, the section of it. You know, it's like, okay, we're going to do an anthology every season. You know, it's going to be different stories. But you're going to feel comfortable in knowing that you're going to see the same faces over and over and over. You know, I think that it was a bold choice and a good choice, because I always feel like anthologies are tough because you're just asking for people to invest it's kind of like Groundhog Day. You're asking everybody to invest every single cycle, you know, every new story.
Right. And they do bring in new voices each time.
They bring in
Cuba Gooding.
Sure.
I give them credit for
that. Yeah, but Channel Zero is going to be like the ultimate testament to see if, okay, you've built up the fan base, you've built up like people who are going to, who are asking for this creepiness, and then you're going to hit the reset button.
Whole new story.
Whole new story, whole new thing. So
I assume whole new director too, because it's probably just Craig.
I think it is a new show, or not a showrunner. I think they are going for a new voice.
Because like, the guy who directed season. The Boy, that you guys all remember,
I'll tell you, man, Channel Zero put him on the map for me, like what he's been doing on that show.
Yeah,
I mean, The Boy is a very good film, but.
Yeah, this is a different level. Yeah.
Which boy?
The Rain Hollywood Wilson, one. The SpectreVision one.
Oh, okay, I got you.
See, that's all I had known him from. But this, I think it's really fantastic. I'm so glad people forced me to watch it.
And let's talk about Ash versus Evil Dead.
I'm behind
this season. Yeah.
I'm not caught up. I have not started this season yet.
It's pretty top notch. Like, I'm so surprised that they have kept up the quality.
Oh, yeah.
Considering last season was like it started out strong and then kind of. But this has been kind of balls to the wall crazy.
It's been like nonstop. Yeah, like they haven't taken a moment to take a breath.
But here, I want to talk about the dire Sunday show, and then we'll talk about the happy one, which is Ash vs. Evil Dead.
Oh.
The dire one being The Walking Dead, which you tapped out a long time ago, right? Yeah. But no, I think it's important because
I got into multiple fights online.
Well, and that's I've been waiting to talk to you about it, Elric, because I had very mixed feelings. I don't want to spoil it, even though everyone already has spoiled it for you if you haven't read it or seen it.
If you go on Facebook, it's everywhere. Yeah, I'm not even watching anymore,
You need a 3-hour break.
Wait, is the outrage that they're sticking to source material? How outrageous it is to stick to source material?
Well, let's talk this out. So,
I talked to a few people who came in the office, and they were genuinely bummed out by how graphic and grim it got.
Yeah, that's my point is that I had a big debate with my roommate about it because he's a big fan of the show. I thought whereas people are accusing The Exorcist of being a cheap trick, I kind of think The Walking Dead is totally kind of cheating and manipulating their audience.
Oh, big time.
The way they ended the last season is unforgivable. And I understand from a narrative reason why they did it. And obviously it worked because the ratings were huge, although not as big as they expected.
I'll shock you. I actually think I felt that way before. Now I think it was an emotional reason, because if they'd given it to you then, you would have all that time to get over the loss. And then starting this season, I think the loss was what's going to fuel this entire season. That's my feeling, the loss and breaking of a major character.
Well, of course. But what's going to happen is they're going to dwell on it for 8 episodes until another significant dramatic beat's going
to
happen.
Yeah. It's a weird show because they have parallel stories, so they'll cut to another story tomorrow. Next week won't even be the story we just watched, right?
I know. I was definitely affected by it. I thought it was Greg Nicotero has proven.
I thought it was incredibly directed.
He did a really good job, but I almost feel like they crossed the line a little too much. And I'm a hardened horror fan.
Yeah.
It was just like brutal. And for this, and I get it. They don't want to cut away. They want you to see the brutality of it and blah, blah, blah. But I felt like you could have gotten the point across with a little less. I think that's the most like vile, grotesque thing that they've ever gotten away with on a television show ever.
I mean, I've never
ever. I dug it up. I had to find it and watch it. And I was just like, ooh.
But it's because it's also engaged you emotionally. And so that some people might not like that feeling. But for me, while watching it, I got to say, I was curled up in a bit of a ball the whole time, and Dick Grinert's wife started filming us, and it's actually pretty funny to watch our reactions, because it's like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this on TV before. But afterwards, as soon as it ended, I was like, no, I feel like that's fully justified. The brutality is so fucking ballsy. It feels like they're doing what Italian horror would be doing, but on TV.
Yeah.
So as the horror person in me goes, no, push the boundaries. Go as far as you can, guys, before you're off air.
That's the thing. Walking Dead finally caught up to the kind of stigma that George Romero's Day of the Dead had when it came out. And people were talking about how grisly the violence was. You know, that became mainstream as soon as The Walking Dead started.
And this is always the show that's been rooted in Day of the Dead. Not Dawn. It's always been Day. It's always been Nicotero as the through line.
But the thing is like, you know, Walking Dead, brought that kind of mainstream. Look how gory it is. Oh, look at the zombie violence. Look how gnarly it can be. Look at those bites. But when you started like really digging down to the marrow and you're doing the actual human violence, like
the human
story. Violence.
It's the Walking Dead or the human.
That's,
we now have that defined
for us.
For
we're
kind
of
right?
like, okay, great. But for the mainstream audience that they've built up over the years.
But that's why it's so fucking subversive, dude.
They're not used to
it. How subversive is it to do that to your audience? I mean, I don't know if they can maintain that, and I don't know what they'll do. But I will say the one thing about it, and I read all the comments, and the only ones that pissed me off, because if somebody wants to quit watching, I'm like, go for it. I saw a lot of comments of people who said, I didn't watch the show, or I didn't even even watch the last season, and then they ragged on it like crazy. And I'm like, dude, watch. Yeah, you know, there's no, I don't. You have no opinion.
Your opinion is not valid. It's not valid if you haven't seen or, you know.
Yeah, getting upset by something makes total sense. But give it a chance. If you stick with it, give it a chance to see why it did it. Because I've always heard that this was the moment in the show in general that was like before Christ, after Christ, right? It's a defining switch of narrative. So, I don't read the comics, so I'm very curious. But what I will say is what it did to a main character, and I'm not going to, this isn't a spoiler, how Rick deals with everything that happens in the story, and Rick is the story. If Rick died, I'll stop watching. It's as simple as that. Like, he to me is the reason I keep watching week after week. What it does to that character, that episode, how they structured the episode of how he was being told the story, if you know what I mean, was so interesting that by the end you're like, oh shit, I actually kind of believe when, you know, when the Negan, the bad guy, says certain things to him, like, oh yeah, it's like breaking a wild stallion or something. And I'm like, I have no idea what's going to happen in the story now. And that's the moment where I was like, I am really glad I stuck with the show all these years, because this is the first time in watching the show that I didn't know what was going to happen now. I have no idea. I could not tell you what 2 weeks from now is going to hold, because I have no, they felt so in danger and overpowered now that I'm like, I can't imagine it's just going to be pure sadism. I think that that show's always taken ebbs and flows. So I totally get the outrage, but I'm also, the part of me that likes things being pushed goes, you know what? Hey, what's going to happen now? You know, and that's exciting.
Regarding the sadism, though, what's funny is I saw, I guess they filmed every single character. And there, I saw one bit that leaked out that was a completely different character.
Yeah.
And I mean, fully edited, put together, and it's grotesque. And I'm like, man, I can't wait for the Blu-ray where I can get to watch every single one of these characters I love die a horrible
death. Did you hear why they did that?
Cool that they did, it's really cool that they had the budget to do single death scene.
But did you hear why they did that?
No. Well, to throw it
No, it was literally, they were so concerned that somebody in the editorial or something would leak.
Oh, right.
That they filmed every single one. And if one leaked, they'd be like, all right. You know, they filmed every single death scene, which is amazing. They knew what was going to happen, but they
could afford that, I guess.
Wow.
I don't know. You know, hey, if you're out, you're out already. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But yeah, I'm more in than ever, actually, after that. Not because I want to say violence is great. More like, oh, I felt it, and now
let
I don't
me ask you this.
It.
Would you watch that episode again?
I don't know. I watched the end of the one before it started, and that helped set the scene. No, but I will say this. Negan's fucking entertaining, and that's the weird thing. It's almost very Tarantino-ish to have the most violent character and most vile, also the most entertaining. He's Michael Madsen in Reservoir Dogs,
right,
is what he is. He's going to start dancing while he cuts off your ear. So it's a weird feeling to be like repulsed by someone, but entertained. He's
well,
funny,
course, you know, a couple episodes previous to all this happening, the entire cast that we've been following did something so morally irrehensible.
Totally.
They broke into a compound and killed a whole bunch of people while they slept.
And people aren't talking about that, and that really bothers me.
Definitely
they were bad guys. Rick was being a bad guy.
Yeah, in that sense. So it's kind of like, you have to remember that's kind of...
Negan had one of the best lines, you know, these aren't spoilers, this last season, he just goes, you killed a lot of my men, a few more than I would have liked. And when he said that, it's like, it's actually funny. It's like,
yeah, because it's like,
I don't know if it can stay
man.
Funny, and I think it's pretty ballsy to play that role, because it might hurt you.
Yeah.
It'll definitely color you with fans, you know?
All righty. But anyway, so that was brutal. And then I went to Ash vs. Evil Dead, which also had some head bashing and kind of brains
falling out,
but in an entertaining way.
Yeah.
No, the show has been fantastic. And the inclusion of Ted Raimi and just doing radical things with the Evil Dead style, like in the last two episodes, the convertible has come alive now and kind of
the Delta has become a character in and of itself,
like,
because
it's been
possessed.
Yeah, it's possessed. Oh my god!
So it acts like a lowrider. It spouts out flames off the side. It's crushed people's heads by bouncing around. It actually has character.
That's fun, yeah.
And it's a lot of fun. And it just cracked me up when Ash finally recognized that something sinister has taken over his car. He's like, oh no, not you, baby. Not you too. Not the classic. It's so good. It's so good. But they wrapped it up. And it's funny because even though they go outside the box a little bit and do some crazy kooky stuff that we've never seen in the Evil Dead universe, they still maintain some of the language. Like when they open up a trunk and there's kind of like this portal. But, you know, it's all fire and kind of brimstone, but you can still hear this kind of rumbling sound of like Deadites chanting or mumbling, like the cabin when it goes, join us. You can hear that. And I'm like, you know what? there's a good team here that understands what the Evil Dead series is, and they always constantly remind you of that, you know. But it's just a fun show.
Has Ted Raimi joined it now?
Oh yeah, he's a regular. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So I'm probably two behind.
Yeah. Childhood best
and Ivan. Oh, okay, Ivan wrote this episode. This past.
Oh,
episode.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
All right. Yeah. I'm definitely gonna keep it.
It's a fun show, man. Yeah. I'm having so much fun with it, and I'm enjoying it a lot more than the first season because the first season there was like a lot of dips and stuff.
Also, a lot of expectations right before it started. What is the tone going to be once you know?
Yeah, I think everybody's fallen into place, and we know, you know, I mean, now Bruce he always has been Ash, but it's kind of like, I don't know, like all the secondary characters, we know who everyone is now. So it's kind of like any scenario you put them in, they can do the Evil Dead version of it, and it's, you know, and it's entertaining.
Also, I'm not going to review it, but just throwing it out in case you didn't know, then Black Mirror's up now.
I only watched
the first one. It was great.
Nosedive.
And it all has movie stars. This thing's like cast out the wazoo.
Yeah, Nosedive. You didn't enjoy it?
Oh, no.
Nosedive,
if you guys haven't watched, Nosedive is about a, you know, it's like, you know, like Black Mirror. It's a little bit 5 minutes into the future.
maybe
1 minute, where everybody's carrying around their phones and every interaction is rated. Yeah. Every interaction. So if I walk by Becca and I'm like, hey, Becca, how's it going? Becca's like, coffee sucks. I'm going to be like, fuck you, 2 stars.
Yeah.
And then like, and it actually, and those ratings.
I would never say
2 stars.
they're like credit reports almost.
They're credit reports. Yeah. And so some people can't go into a hotel if they have less than a 4-point rating.
It's so bleak.
And it basically is about this one woman who is trying to achieve, like, you know, a high 4 to 5 stars to get into this new place that she wants to live in and get away from her brother and blah, blah, blah. So one of her old friends from high school asks her to be the bridesmaid, and she's got to basically give the speech. But she's doing a speech in front of nothing but 4.5 and above.
Yeah, to get her rating up.
To get her rating up. And I was sweating the entire time. Like, I got anxiety. It made me so uncomfortable to watch this.
And it's shot in a Tim Burton-esque, like, the aesthetic is the start of Edward Scissorhands, where everything's pastel-y and bright and happy. And everyone's got a fake smile on their face. And all I'm thinking is, man, I can take the end of that Walking Dead episode. This is disturbing. Like, this is my threshold. Like, if the world goes that way, I don't want to be part of that world.
Oh,
it's awful.
Seriously, I don't know if you guys ever watched the show Community, but there's an episode that's that same thing, but it's a comedy.
This has funny parts, but
and it's where they invent an app and they test it at the school, but you rate everything that the person does with these things called meow meow beans, and they look like little cats, and they form separate societies based on who has the most meow meow beans, and it's hilarious.
I know Brian Collins
telling. Brian, I'm there with you on that one.
It was an awesome night at the Turek household on Friday night. I was just catching up on so much TV.
Think about it. We just spent the first 30 minutes just talking about TV.
And so let me bring the conversation down and talk to my listeners out there who do listen to Scream Queens. Scream Queens season two is...
We are now cutting to a commercial break. The rest of us will eat pizza while Ryan talks to himself.
I think it's hilarious. The show really cracks me up. They have this killer running around a hospital. It actually plays to 80s horror slasher tropes more than ever this time. It's a little bit more focused than last year, which is saying a lot.
Not more focused than that pilot.
But
I didn't make it past the pilot.
It's still going. It cracks me up. They killed off a pivotal character that I loved. I was waiting for him to come back. He finally came back, and then they killed him off. And the killer's still running rampant. But they had God, I wish I could quote it, but there was this great little aside they had about John Carpenter's Halloween, where someone was like a millennial. She was like, I've never seen John Carpenter's Halloween. And they were like, what are you kidding? And they just went off on her. And I was like, okay, that's good.
One day.
Well, I wanted to mention, since you mentioned Black Mirror, I haven't had a chance to dive in, but I love this. Back on our old show, Killer POV, I was a huge fan of The Fall.
Yeah, me too.
Which was the serial killer.
Oh, yeah.
From Netflix.
Yeah.
Season 3, October 29th.
Oh, cool.
So literally.
I thought that already happened.
No, I mean.
This is 3.
This is the third, It ended in a way that it could have just ended, and I would have been completely satisfied. But now that I know there's more episodes coming, I'm really stoked for it. So.
And by the time this episode drops, or right after, I think the day after this is when Oz Perkins, our last guest film, will finally hit Netflix.
That's right. Yeah, that's true.
And it was
that's
on the front cover of Rue Morgue, which I thought was great timing after we had
it. Oh, yeah.
So I'm really excited.
Oh, so The Fall is now. You can watch it now, today.
Oh, cool.
When this episode airs.
Terrific.
All right, movie-wise.
Yeah.
Good TV, guys. This is a good sign for
a lot of TV. Yeah. All right. Who wants to go first?
I will. I watched a lot because I was sick much of the weekend. So I started out with The Conjuring 2, which I had not seen because I was at a convention the weekend that they did the big press screening of it here in LA. Yeah. And then I never made it to the theater, and I would just kept saying, oh, I'll get it eventually. I'll get it eventually. So I finally watched it, and it was freaking awesome. Definitely didn't do quite as much for me as the first one did, but that could be because I saw the first one theatrically with you, gents, and the second one I was watching in my living room. I definitely did enjoy it, except for the Crooked Man segment, which pulled me out.
Yeah, I'm a little mixed on that, but I love both movies. I think they're both excellent and well-made. What's interesting is I think the A story, which will be the main haunting story, in part one is better, but the relationship between the Warrens is much more better in two.
And
I mean, I always cite the Elvis scene, you know.
It's great.
I miss character moments like that, to be honest.
Well, I think
because you know them now from the first movie, already are established with this relationship where you get to see things like that play out. And you're like, oh, that's pretty sweet.
Anytime they're on screen together, it's on par with the first film.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's two movies, and they come together at a certain point. But there are two separate parallel stories, and the British one's good, and I like the old man's creepy, but it's never as strong as when we see
I have to rewatch it. I really liked it, but I want to do a second analysis of it. I remember just being awed on the pure craftsman level of what James did. It felt like every 5 minutes he was doing like a scary set
there
piece.
Was so many set pieces, and so many of them they just pull you in, and you're like, oh my gosh,
you could hand him a tired trope and he will fucking scare the shit out of you. Like, that's the thing. And not many people can do that. I mean, he's in his own class now.
And it was right at the beginning of the film, so this isn't spoiling anything about it. But this girl is in her room, and she's looking around, and she sees all of these faces, and it kind of trips you out because you're like, there's faces everywhere. And she flips on the light, and it's just posters on the wall. So simple, but the way that they pulled it off, it was just like, I don't know why that isn't done more often. That was just great.
It's a heck of a
thing. So then after I watched The Conjuring 2, that definitely got me in the mood for, I'll call it, a older British movie about a haunted house and a film crew there, which I swear it pulled a lot from. So I went back and watched Ghostwatch.
Oh, the one that they gave me at trivia?
The one that they gave you at trivia.
I should have watched it too.
You should have watched
it. Don't spoil it for me then, because I'll take my hit.
I won't. I'll just say a little bit about what it is, and then I'll say this is why Elric needs to watch it. So it was done. It was presented on BBC as a real thing. So this is
that Ghostwatch?
Like, yeah.
Come on.
Somebody get
watch that shit. So it was presented on BBC as an actual live documentary live investigative reporting on ghosts, where they were actually going into this house that the kids thought that one of them thought that she was possessed. There was something, some creepy stuff going on. And they were going to go into this house and investigate and stay there all night. And then they're also taking calls from people at home and reports of other stuff and showing creepy photographs. And so they've got all this stuff going on for 2 hours while they're doing this on Halloween night. They present it as real, and apparently people actually believed it. And I do have to say, the way that I saw Ghostwatch was my parents had a VHS copy of it when I was a kid, early 90s probably. We had a VHS copy of it. And the first time I saw it, I didn't realize that it was fake. So I was watching it as a documentary, oh my God.
War of the Worlds moment or something.
Yeah. And apparently that's how it kind of originally broadcast. Yeah.
Well, it's because as soon as somebody handed me the copy, the guy on the cover, oh God, you guys are gross. Uniformly gross. The guy on the cover is a famous BBC host. And so when somebody handed it, I was like, oh, what is this? Because I recognize that guy from when I was a kid. He was the BBC commentator. So they've obviously gone to painstaking lengths to make it feel.
And it's very legitimate. Yeah. It feels real. Even bad band between the commentators and things like that. So I highly recommend watching it. And it was a good companion piece to Conjuring 2, because you can feel that Conjuring 2 actually pulls a little bit from it at moments. I finally got to see Purge Election Year, another one that I
missed.
Welcome
to the company, Becca.
I know, right? Do you know how many times I'd asked for screeners of that and finally got one right before it was sent out? So I know.
Becca, just call me.
So I finally got a screener after, July. And absolutely loved it. Thought it was it was my favorite so far.
Oh, cool.
Probably
right.
Because it entered into the social realm. I do have to say it's not as horror as the other ones. It felt more just kind of like a straight action film.
Yeah.
It definitely had some creepy moments and stuff, but it didn't feel quite as intensely horror as much as just kind of like badass action.
Should I watch it the night before the election? Because I've been thinking about it. Sure. I haven't seen
it's so perfect timing. It's perfect
I figured
timing.
With Trump and everything, like, I'm like, all right, this could be a good time.
The social commentary in it is so perfect for this election. Right. It's
ironically.
Spot on.
Okay, cool. I'm looking forward to that.
And then the weird one that I watched was Dead End Drive-In.
The Aussie one?
The Aussie one, which I had never seen before. And so I put it on and I absolutely loved the plot, but I had issues with the execution.
Is that Brian Trenchard Smith?
I don't know who directed it. I should.
I think so.
I think it is.
We'll look from that up.
Like that Crow-esque cover.
Yeah,
the Crow-esque cover is nowhere in the movie. But it's essentially, it's like this post-apocalyptic society where there's like a definite lower class, and then there's this class of punk kids who are really disillusioned, and metal is really valuable. So you'll see people like sawing down street signs to steal the metal from it, and like stealing the metal off of cars that have just been in car wrecks before the paramedics show up and things like that.
When you actually talk to our guest when he finally does come, you'll find that's just regular life.
That's just Aussie life.
Part of the country. Part and parcel.
But there's this whole kind of like disillusioned youth who's really, you know, crimey and punk. And one night, two of them go to a drive-in, this really rural drive-in. And the next morning, or they discover that night that their tires have been stolen, so they can't leave. And they're told to stay the night and we'll see what we can do for you. And they wake up the next morning and there's this entire civilization of disillusioned youths who live at this drive-in because they have been trapped there because somebody has stolen parts off their cars. They can't leave. Nothing works anymore. And they can't leave because it's in this electrified fence and it's like in this rural area and it's actually illegal to walk down the highway that leads back to town. And after a while, you kind of get this idea that the government is holding them there because they don't want these people out in society.
Sounds like the Bad Batch.
It's kind of like, it's like No Exit.
I don't know about you, but I tuned out.
Yeah. It's like Sartre's No Exit, but in a drive-in.
I think you just sold every horror fan when you quoted Sartre. They're like, oh, he's my favorite French existential philosopher.
Existentialism and horror, I'm so there. Yeah. And so there were parts of it that I really liked, but at the same time, it definitely had this kind of campy, which is somewhat Australian.
Max,
yeah, it's very post-Mad Max.
It's in that world.
It really had this kind of campy overtone to it. So it, even though that it had this very dark tone where after a while they accept the fact that they're there and decide to stay at the drive-in, it's weird.
It's definitely in the sci-fi kind of, that low-budget stuff. I remember really digging it as a kid, but that's the kind of thing Australia was pumping out for a little period there, so...
There's
something. When they had the money.
There's definitely a social commentary and something more to it, but it gets kind of
Turkey
washed.
Shoot is another one that's kind of in that vein. You know? There's kind of weird satires, you know.
Yeah.
But they had that tax loophole. They don't have it anymore. Yeah. You know,
got to make some crazy movies under that.
Yeah, Sartre in a drive-in.
There you go.
I have a couple I want to throw out because they were released on Blu-ray this week, and I can't advocate these movies enough. One, I can't believe that has slipped through my my viewage. The Beautiful Fiends at Severn Films have released Burial Ground.
Oh, my God. It's gorgeous. God. I just got it 2 days ago.
It's out on Blu-ray as of this week. It is not only is it pristine, but I had never seen this movie. And within the first – I wrote an article on the site about it. Within the first 15 minutes – it's like Pieces. I got up. I started pacing. I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Yeah.
But I thought it was like borderline brilliant. not good
Mother,
by any means.
It smells like death.
Oh,
in
yeah,
fact, the Pieces director
is
like, I need to make a Fulci film. The Pieces director making a Fulci film.
That
boom.
Is the perfect analogy.
With a weird midget child thing. We don't know who he was.
With Peter Bark.
Peter Bark. Yeah.
Let me tell you, Peter Bark was a little man that was hired to play a child in the movie. And that's the photo that you see
online.
Now, what's great is that Peter Bark, bless him, is still alive.
Oh, wow.
Because there's a special feature of him doing a Q&A.
Oh, my God. I am buying this on Amazon right now.
And apparently, it's weird. I looked it all up because at this Q&A, he said he wrote a book, like kind of explaining everything that happened on Burial Ground. Yet I looked online and couldn't find this book.
He never published it. He just wrote it.
He never published it.
Like I wrote a book.
But that was like the highlight, was watching this crazy movie. And also, I mean, it's got like, it's not bad, but it's like the way certain things are executed are just so ridiculous that it's almost like bordering on amazing. Like, I'm sure with a group, it's amazing, this movie.
Yeah.
Because like, there's one point where the door swings open and the little kid's coming. And I mean, it's at least 2 minutes where the shadow's just kind of coming to frame. for 2 minutes, and then finally he pops in the door. You're like, that was the longest reveal of all time, so but kind of funny.
I've always thought that all the people who review Fulci and they say, oh, he's kind of a clunky director, I think they saw Burial Ground
and thought that was
Fulci, and that's what gave him a bad rap.
Right. And I think, you know what? Movie. I kind of like the zombies in it, too.
Yeah, no, they look good. They
look real zombies?
With masks.
But they do move real slow.
But Peter Bark, man, you know, shout out to Severin.
Yeah,
I can't, like, of all films to restore, like, in pristine quality, I can't believe that that's one of them. But
I've only seen it on VHS. A long time ago.
Yeah. That's and crazy. The other one is Waxworks, which came out through Lionsgate as part of their Vestron line. They've already done Shopping Mall. They've already done Blood Diner. This is terrific. I love the movie. It was one of my recommendations for the month. So I actually had Scott Reynolds and his kid Zane over to see because they'd never seen it before. I'm a sucker for monster mashes. So you throw more than one monster in a movie and I'm pumped. The movie looks great. It's in widescreen for the first time, I think, ever.
Did you watch part two as well, or just part one?
I only watched part one. I haven't gone to two because I didn't really like two. I've never liked two except for some of the Bruce Campbell stuff in it. But I have an appreciation for it now because, well, first of all, there's like a vintage 24-minute making of, which is really great because they show a lot of behind the scenes from the time the movie was made in the late 80s. And then, you know, Red Shirt Pictures did the... I think it's like a 6-part documentary. Wow. It's like 90 minutes long if you watch it all in
a row. A 3-hour documentary on Waxworks.
It's pretty intense, but I mean, there's a lot of interesting tidbits about the making of it.
They're really creative movies, both of them. Even the sequel, even though it doesn't work as well, it's still creative.
Yeah, there's
it's
cool stuff in it. That's why now I'm kind of curious to revisit that one. You know what it is like? I'll always watch it right after part one and then be completely disappointed.
Right.
So I want to give it a little room before I go to the second one so I can watch it out of context.
I'm looking forward to seeing that again.
But yeah, so that was great. And the last thing I want to mention is Daniel Budnick, who is over at Bleeding Skull, who wrote the books Bleeding Skull and has been on a killer POV before. You know, we've had Phantasm on the Brain, Don Coscarelli. I had never seen, it's not a horror movie, but I'd never seen Kenny and Company, which was his film before Phantasm.
Never seen it.
So we got together and we did a double bill of Kenny and Company and Bubba Hotep, which could not have played together more beautifully. First of all, Kenny and Company is just magical. I really love this movie. It's got, you know, some Halloween stuff in it because it follows a bunch of kids. I don't know, what are they, 12 or so?
Is it a kids movie?
Kind of, but
same,
you know,
actor
what?
As Phantasm.
Yeah, he's in it. Reggie Bannister's the teacher. You know, it's a lot of the same characters. It's more of a coming of age kind of it's comedy drama from like the late 70s.
So Coscarelli's what, 17, 18?
He's got to be super young. Yeah.
Insane, because Phantasm, he's 20.
Coscarelli is 22. The youngest out of the, I think he's the youngest out of the
of the
Masters
of
Horror?
By far. Yeah. So it's just, you know, the problem is it's hard to get because Anchor Bay put a DVD out, and I believe whatever studio put it out owns it currently. It's not one of those things where Don owns the rights to it. But if you could find it, it's a really magical movie, and it just
you still have it?
No, Dan brought it over.
Okay, I got
it. But you got
really
you got to check it out.
I've
because
always
it
wanted
was,
to see. Yeah.
It was one of those movies where from start to finish, I just had a smile. And I mean, you know, there's some questionable stuff that kids do, but it's like it was the 70s. Like, you know, there's one they pick on Sherman, the kid that lives across the street, by putting like a mousetrap in a paper bag and holding it out. Like, here's some candy.
Yeah.
Like, the sort of stuff that kids today should not see.
Yeah.
But for some reason, it feels safe in the
70s.
And the best thing about it, actually, which Dan told me from the commentary, there's a great scene. Halloween night happens, and they run through a garage that's like built to be a maze, like a haunted house maze.
Mm-hmm.
And when they showed it to theaters, that was the scene that got the biggest reaction out of the audience. And that's why Don wanted to do a horror movie, because he'd already made two features. This is his second feature. Seeing the audience react to that one scene was like, ooh, I like how they react to the horror stuff.
He got addicted to the fan reaction. That's cool.
Yeah, so that's how that came about. And I mean, it was great because you're watching a filmmaker with such a vibrant voice at the very beginning of his career commenting on youth, and then doubling it up with him commenting on old age and the elderly with Bubba Hotep. I'll talk about Bubba Hotep a little bit closer to when the Blu-ray comes out, because that's in November. And I want to really dive into all the special features.
We can all watch it and catch up.
Yeah,
that's
it.
That's
a great.
I'll say is I love it. I love that movie so much, and it's probably the best performance, as goofy as it is, best performance that Bruce has ever given in anything.
Sorry.
Yeah, totally agree with that.
I was away from the mic.
I can fire through a couple if you want.
Sure,
quick
go for it.
The all haunting ones, ironically, not even planned. The only one that was planned for the show was revisiting The Haunting, because I hadn't seen it in 20 years.
Oh, the original.
And it came on TCM. I've recorded. Actually, I've decided something for November. Some people might want to take me up on this because we kind of burn ourselves out with, you know, the horror. I decided for Noirvember, I'm going to actually do all black and white horror for my son. Not every day or anything, but I'm going to like try to catch up on – I recorded all the Val Luden ones. They all came on TCM. I recorded a bunch of – I recorded Hexen. I recorded a bunch
of
stuff.
Have you seen Dementia yet? Not Dementia 13.
I've seen Dementia just 13, Dementia. Not Dementia.
You need to watch Dementia. My favorite –
Black and White?
Black and White. No, my favorite film of the 50s and like nobody's seen
it. Yeah, no, look it up. So I just thought that would be a fun twist for November so you can kind of take a backseat with older films. Anyway, so The Haunting, I won't waste your time because most of you, you know, a lot of you had cited as one of the greatest haunting, and it really is. It's, you know, Robert Wise is the director. He did Star Trek, but he was the editor on Magnificent Ambersons for Orson Welles. He's an incredible editor. It's just so beautifully crafted and beautifully shot and beautifully sound designed. You don't see anything really in terms of the actual hauntings, but you feel all the palpable emotion. It's just a great, really well-constructed movie. Highly recommend.
Looks amazing on Blu-ray, by the way.
Yeah, and this was probably the similar kind of aesthetic. I imagine because TCM, they have really nice transfers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It felt great. I followed it up with there's a company doing, you know, truly great work. I want to really put them on the map. The Blumhouse Company, when they make a movie, you fucking listen, okay? That's you at right. home. You okay. go to the movie theater and you spend your dollars on Mike Flanagan's movies. Right. so I did see Ouija 2.
Oh,
excellent.
And I saw a little Ryan Turek thank you. Not thank you, but a production credit. So that was nice to see.
Hey.
My first year?
Yeah, because it's been a while. Yeah,
I mean,
it takes a while. People forget. It takes a couple years.
Well, I didn't realize. Well, that's the thing. Like, Collins is the only one who rides my ass about it because he's like, when am I going to see your name on there? Yeah. And he's like, what about Purge Anarchy, what'd you do? Not Anarchy, Election Year. And I was like, well, I didn't really get to development, you know, but I'm not going to get credit for it. But no, it's pretty
this
cool.
Is, I'm gonna
I didn't even realize. I didn't realize until Collins texted me from the theater. He was like,
have you seen it with any audiences? I'm curious.
I saw it at the premiere.
Okay.
It played really well. I mean, like, look.
I'm always curious how it plays the audience. So we saw, like, there's only four people in our theater last night, but it didn't matter. I mean, it still played the scare as well. You know, look, it's awesome to see Flanagan is top notch of his craft right now.
Yeah.
In a way, like Juan. Like, Juan is, like, definitely ahead in terms of just pure craft. But Flanagan, the first two acts are really solid, and there's great craftsmanship, great character build-up. The third act is so absolutely wonderful and fun and deranged, and there's gags in there that I have yet to ever see, even though I've seen all the tropes of the movie play out before. I've never seen some of these actual, you know, gags. There's one in particular that plays within the new Ouija, you know, the old Ouija, but the one that's set in the contemporary world, where there's a guy who hangs himself in the Ouija film, just called Ouija, and they do something with a moment like that is so, like, kind of bonkers in the moment that I was like, holy shit, I've never seen that before. I actually said it out loud in the middle of a movie. So I thought the last act was so much fun. I think the casting of the mother and the youngest daughter is the most freakish fucking thing I've ever seen in movies, because they look like, if somebody told me, yeah, it's her daughter, and I'd go, yeah, of course it is, because their bone structure is exactly the same. Like, it is the best casting I've ever seen. You know, the middle daughter is awesome. She's in a few of Flanagan's films.
Yeah.
It's a really fun movie. I think it's a huge leap from the other. You know, the other Ouija was okay. It actually wasn't on the hater side. It just isn't a very good movie. It's a contemporary film. It's very generic, but this is the opposite of that. This isn't generic. It felt like it was actually in the world of the Conjuring movies. It felt like if this was called Annabelle, the good version of that. You know what I mean? It had that kind of style. Really cool movie. I actually really enjoyed it, and I kind of wish there was more people in the theater. You know, it was a Tuesday night or whatever, so you can't expect much. But I'm looking forward to you guys, like, checking it out, because the gags are really good.
Yeah, I highly recommend going to see it. It was really fun.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it. I intended to go this weekend, like, but sickness. So
yeah,
that's fair.
I think you'll dig it. And then just on the back, it's kind of similar, actually. But in the same structure of the first two acts being much more build up and really delivering on the last, is Under the Shadow, the film set in the Iran-Iraq War, set in the 80s. Babak Anari is the director. This is one that I'd been really excited to see all year.
They ran this at Cinefamily, right?
Yeah, it played one time.
It played a couple times.
It played at Sundance Cinema. And it's one that, you know, people, if it's in my wheelhouse of the kind of foreign art house, it definitely had a Babadook type structure.
Well, wait. So, yeah, you had mentioned that when I was describing it, that, like, you would be into it. Did you, like, is this an Elric stamp of approval?
Yeah, look, it's like, because the other one I'm looking forward to is the one we were talking about the other night, Eyes of My Mother. This one I haven't seen yet. Those are the two this year, I think, that I, like, you know, besides Oz's film, that I'm really looking forward to. You know, it's really good. The first two acts are, and when I say there's no, you know, how, say in Ouija, there's still dread momentum, right, from start. You know bad things are happening. And this, there really isn't even that. The first two acts are really kind of social realism. It's kind of funny. It's, like, set in Iran, but the mother is working out to the Jane Fonda workout. tape, yeah, and it's really cool. So I really love that. But once the horror comes in, it's actually pretty fucking scary for a couple moments where it's a Dijin myth. So I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. So it's Jin, you know, Jin. Haunting complex. That's an apartment
is
the complex.
There, or is no, it no, just
yeah, what's
Jin?
A D?
It's just,
D-J-I-N.
It's just Jin.
The failed movie that we'll never see by Tobe Hooper, or you will, and you'll regret
it. No, it's on Netflix.
Okay, yeah. It's on there. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a time where we wanted to watch it, and then,
it's rough. It's rough.
But it is a really smart film. It's got a really high, you know, Rotten Tomato rating. I really did like it. I don't think I just short of me going, oh my God, it's because I felt like I had seen a lot of these kind of similar tropes. And Babadook, it's the mother and the daughter, and they're trying to survive this kind of scenario. But what's really smart is it's looking at like kind of why hauntings happen, I think. And we're going to obviously be talking about that today in general, but like it's usually when something changes, like everyone's abandoning this apartment complex because missiles are – the place is being bombed. And so when – and then the husband has gone off to war, so it's just these two. So when there's – when something is taken out of this family structure and it's a society that rejects women and women are treated absolutely awfully. One time she goes outside running from a ghost and somebody like – you know, they're almost going to give you lashes because you're outside without wearing a head scarf. You know, so it's [S2] Wow. [S1] So it's a very smart political – film, but once the actual horror starts, I think you wouldn't be disappointed. It just takes a little while to get to it. So I like it. Not quite love, but I thought it's a really solid film.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, people, it's exciting when these films are being, I mean, that's how I felt about Baskin as well. I liked it more than Baskin personally, but I love that these are movies emerging from markets where we haven't been getting horror films.
Yeah.
And I think there's voices that once that connects, they have a lot to make a horror film about. Right, you know what I mean? Right. Like there's a lot of baggage to expel in a film like this. So, yeah. And that one's on demand now. Yeah. So you can check that out.
Very cool.
Really quick. I got just two. One is a Blu-ray release, The Pit.
Oh,
man. I know you guys have discussed this here. This
the
is
weird
again.
Bathtub
I don't think
scene.
We really have because I remember who had seen it.
I remember Becca brought it up at one time, but I mean,
we discussed it on Killer POV because Elric and I had both watched it kind of back to
back.
Yeah,
this was one of those kind of weird, like Ryan filling in the gaps in his horror, horror library, and I'd never seen it before. This movie's batshit nuts. Like this fucking
so
kid in this movie. If you guys haven't heard of nor seen The Pit. It's about a little boy who has a pit in the woods that he like pushes people into, and there are these creatures that live at the bottom of the pit. And at the same time, he's a little sexually repressed, and he also has a teddy bear that talks to him.
And is alive in some way.
And is alive in some way, shape, or form. Anyways, it's a really fucking weird-ass movie. And the Blu-ray looks great. I haven't poured through the special features yet, but I will. But do yourself a favor. If you like weirdo, batshit, crazy cinema, this is a good fit. And then another film that I caught it at an agency screening, but they played it at Screamfest, so I think I'm safe to talk about it. It's called Bodom. Oh. It's a Finnish horror film that's being presented here as Lake Bodom. And it's about these two girls who get invited by these two high schoolers to go to a lake that has kind of like a notorious history. There was a series of murders that
apparently
were there.
It's real.
Yeah. No, it's based on a real case where I think four campers were discovered in their tent, beaten and slashed to death. And so this
three
was just
and one injured.
Oh, okay. There you go. So this was just kind of like one of those, we don't have the actual like facts as to what happened, but this is just kind of our story about it, you know? Right. So it's about these two girls that go out with these two boys and it's hard to discuss because there's twist on top of twist on top of twist, but it's really well done. You know, it's kind of got this. It's one of those a film that you look to see what the filmmaker is capable of, even though it might not have a lot of substance. You know, it's stylistically impressive. The cast is great. The violence is brutal. But it's not pushing us into any new territory. It's kind of like Wolf Creek-esque. Uh-huh. But it was really well done. I don't know what the distribution strategy is yet for the film.
And it's an actual Finnish film, like from Finland.
Yeah. Yep.
So again, like a market, I don't think I've ever seen a horror film from Finland when I actually think about it. Like Norway and other countries I have. But
yeah.
That's cool.
It's cool. It was a little like breath of fresh air. And again, I'll keep you posted as I find out, you know, who picks it up. But pretty good stuff.
Nice.
Cool.
Cool. That's all I got. We should bring on our guest.
Yeah. We should. He's going to
hang
out. Pizza.
Yes. Haunted houses.
I'm going to cough on every slice.
Get spooky.
It's no secret. We at Shockwaves are huge fans of horror. On film, on TV, and especially in person. Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Hollywood brings together the sickest minds in horror to immerse guests in a living, breathing, three-dimensional world of terror. Now through November 5th, 2016, Halloween Horror Nights features a new slate of unrivaled film and television production quality mazes, frightful scare zones, and a fully reimagined terror tram experience, all uniquely themed to today's most definitive horror properties, like The Exorcist, American Horror Story, Halloween, Hell Comes to Haddonfield, Freddy vs. Jason, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Krampus, The Walking Dead, and The Purge Election Year. These mazes are scary as hell, and we will be telling you about each of them in graphic detail over the next few weeks. As Southern California's most extreme Halloween event, Halloween Horror Nights is designed to taunt, terrorize, and torment guests as they navigate the darkness from one frightening maze to another. Tickets are available for purchase at www.halloweenhorrornights.com/Hollywood, including a front-of-line ticket option that enables guests to enjoy priority access to each of the Halloween Horror Nights mazes and the Terror Tram, a theme park ride. Advance purchase is recommended as events nights will sell out. Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Hollywood. Nobody does Halloween better. Visit HalloweenHorrorNights.com/Hollywood now for more info and to get your tickets.
Okay, and welcome back to the show. Sitting with us is a very, very special guest. Pretty good writer, but honestly, I'm excited because he's a star of Matrix Reloaded. Lee Whannell, welcome.
Thank you.
Can I tell you how excited I was? Because I hadn't seen those movies since they came out, and then I did a marathon last year. I just wanted to watch all three, and when I got to the second one, I got so excited that you're in. I was like, oh, my, that's right. He acts a lot, too, and he was in the Matrix sequel.
I like Death Sentence, Lee Whannell.
Yeah, me too, but, you know.
Both, well, yeah. Death Sentence, even less running time than The Matrix. But The Matrix was, yeah, that was like the happiest day of my life
was
when
really?
I learned I got that role. I mean, the thing with actors, not that I act very much, but the happiest day of your life is when you get told you've got the role. Easily. Far outweighs the actual being on set doing it. Like, if you want to hear an actor complain, give them a job. It takes about 5 minutes for you on a film set to be like, my feet are cold. It's like, but the day your agent calls and says you've got the job, you just lose your mind. It's like heroin times a million. Wow. And so that day was amazing. And it was only a really small role in The Matrix Reloaded, but it took a month to shoot because, you know, those giant blockbusters take ages. They shoot like
years.
1 second a day. So I was up in Sydney for a month and it was so fun being on the ship with all the little green code and it was incredible.
Yeah.
But even, and then I went to the premiere and even I didn't like it. I was the target audience with a sledgehammer. Not only was I a massive Matrix fanboy, but I was in the freaking movie. So I couldn't have been more primed to love it. And even I at the end was like, eh.
Yeah. Well, I was joking before. I think you're a fantastic writer, but the reason I brought that up is because I don't really know for sure. I mean, obviously you're well known as a writer and you act in a lot of stuff that you write, but what was kind of first for you in terms of getting into the industry? Did you go at it in the angle of being an actor, or was writing always an important aspect of being in the film business?
Yeah, and I was going to say, we should list off some of the, for the listeners who don't know who Lee is.
Yeah.
Lee,
no, just Matrix.
If you're listening to Shockwave, you should know who Lee is. However,
we have a pretty deep
credits,
audience.
Credits like Saw and Insidious and
how many franchises has this guy launched?
I know, I'm just saying.
They should know.
We got to do a little throat clearing and get out there.
Too. Yeah. I just realized.
Oh my God. This one over here with this the IMDb. One.
Yeah, I used to research my interviews 2 seconds before I did them too.
I know, right?
So I know how that works.
Just so you all know where we're coming from here.
Yeah.
I guess I started off wanting to be an actor. I mean, when I was in very, very young, like about 3 years old, I became obsessed with movies. And, you know, when you're that age, as I'm sure everyone at this table can attest, and I'm sure everyone at this table has the same story, you don't quite know what a movie is yet. You know, when you're that young, you don't know about actors and lines and directors. There's just this thing happening in front of you that you love. I remember my dad came home. I grew up in Melbourne in Australia, and my dad came home one day from work, and he was holding a Betamax video recorder the size of like a bar fridge. And my grandfather had won it in a golf tournament, and he said, he was like, I don't know what to do with this thing, you have it, and gave it to my dad. And so my dad brings home this and was like, now we can rent Beta movies. And we went to the video store, to the Beta section, which was like, you know, my generation's version of like coloured bathrooms or something. It was a struggle.
No.
It was like way up the back there.
The Betas were in the back of the bus.
Even in Australia, the Beta was like subservient to the VCR
yes.
too.
So okay. This was, I guess this was like early to mid 80s, but we went to the video store. It was mostly VHS, and then you'd have the one crappy Beta section. Wow. And I remember seeing Jaws. I saw the cover for Jaws and I was like, I want that. I didn't know what it was, but I was like, that's the movie I want. And my dad wouldn't let me. We ended up going home with Popeye, starring Robin Williams and Shelley Duvall.
The most coked out Popeye.
Yeah, and amazing. But I was just, from that point onwards, I was obsessed with movies. And, you know, in Australia, culturally, we get all the same movies that you guys do and a lot of the TV that you guys have. So you're very influenced by America and the content that's coming out of America. So, I was obsessed with movies, and then I just started acting and writing. And I guess the point of my long-winded story that's possibly not good for a podcast is that I didn't know what I wanted to do. I wasn't like, I want to be an actor or I want to be a writer. I wanted something to do with movies. Mm-hmm. And so I used to write plays and then act and stuff. And then I guess I just didn't know what I exactly wanted to do. And then when I went to film school and met James Wan, he was such a good director. He was like the rock star of my film school. He made all the great – he was the one that everyone was envious of. And so when we finished film school, I basically hoodwinked him into working with me. I was like, you need a writer, which was true. Even James would admit if he was here, he made these great little short films, but they always had terrible stories. So I guess you could say I got into writing through, you know, in a roundabout sort of way through a love of movies. And then, you know, I also liked acting, so I'd stick my head in the movies. And it's sort of, not to sound wanky as we say in Australia, but it's all one thing to me.
Right.
But I really do believe that. I don't believe there's much of a difference between acting and writing. It's sort of all an extension of creativity.
Mm-hmm. How did you feed that artistic that thing? I mean, were you constantly reading and constantly watching stuff and constantly, you know, comic books play a part? Any of that stuff?
I mean, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like, I guess I went through the stages. You know, like when I was super young, I was so into like Saturday morning cartoons and Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and went through that obsession, and then. I guess I would feed it by just doing anything creative I could. Like I used to write stories. Like I was famous at my primary school or elementary school, as you would call it. You see how I'm adjusting the lingo to suit an American audience.
Which form is that?
Yeah, exactly. We've got a New Zealander here.
Second form?
Yeah. So I remember I was famous at my primary school for writing a really, really long story. It was the Lord of the Rings of Scoresby Primary School. It was probably like 17 pages. But to the kids at my school, I may as well have written a 1,000-page novel, because kids would come up to me. I was known at that school. Kids would come up to me and be like, are you the kid that wrote that really long book in the library? And which I will now confess, I've actually written a blog post about this, but for anyone who missed it, I stole the idea for the long book.
Oh.
No one knew about it. It was the story of a great mouse detective. And nobody at my school, no teacher was like,
sure.
Listen, man, I know you plagiarized that fucking mouse. Like nobody ever, and none of the kids caught on. Not one kid at my school was like, hey, I saw an animated movie last night that was your, I changed the title.
From Great Mouse Detective to.
It was like Really Good Mouse Detective. And
superb
mouse who investigates.
Well, I remember the mouse in the movie, his name was Basil. I love that movie to this day.
Yeah.
I still remember the names of the mice detective. I'm not going to pretend I don't. It was Timey and Herman. Those were the two mice. But anyway, nobody picked up on my robbery. But that's what I would do to sort of be in it, you know. And then when I was 15, somebody forced me to watch Friday the 13th Part 6 or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, don't make
wait,
me watch
wait,
this.
Wait, or wait. Something. Part 6 or was it Part 7 or 5?
It was
come
the
on,
one where
define.
He gets stabbed in the heart and then the lightning hits yeah. the space.
Oh, okay.
Part 6, yeah.
So you didn't actually steal, sir. You wrote the novelization yeah. of Great yeah. Mouse Detective.
Yeah, I did. I novelized it. Well, actually, it's based on a book, so I stole the whole thing. But so, yeah, it was. I guess it was an evolution that you guys are familiar with. You start out with loving Star Wars and then somewhere in your mid-teens, somebody makes you watch Halloween and you start going down the horror path. And then when I went to film school, I took a hard left turn into Artsyville.
Yeah.
Like, and I was straight out of the suburbs and then all of a sudden you're at school with people who, like, you know, their idea of a good time at the movies is,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
a two-hour shot of a German guy
or like
at a ladle.
Those
are
Elric movies.
I'm still
there
movies.
Sometimes.
Yeah,
I'm
still that's
there.
Elric movies.
Well, you get all those out of your system. At, yeah. I've
Well, no, that stuff, I mean, that is part of your education. You need that stuff because mm-hmm. that informs a lot of other things. I mean, like when I went to film school, I was the kid who brought Escape from LA on Laserdisc, and I was like, guys, I just bought this from Tower Records. Look at this. And they were like, oh, look at that shit. Why didn't you buy Kurosawa's, you know? And I was
right.
like, well, what do you want? I like that stuff.
I remember seeing Michael Bay's top 10 once, and like when he moved here, and last year Marion Bad was number 2. And I remember thinking, that's the thing, that these people love something, but then what they make can be totally different.
Exactly,
like he's
yeah.
influenced by this art house French film, but it doesn't mean he's going to make that.
Right.
And so I think we all kind of go to that. Well,
I agree. Sorry, yeah. go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think once people in film school, I think once everybody realized that Star Wars wasn't really an original concept and it was based on like a couple. Yeah, all that kind of, and we were like, oh, got that. Okay, right. We should be looking to these films, you know, to inform right. you take what you can from those films and then you apply it to what you really like. So it's yeah. like I'll watch Hidden Fortress and go, how can I apply the Friday the 13th?
Oh, right. Right. You'll remember like this. Right. What's the name of that Japanese pinky film? He directed like rape revenge movies in Japan, yeah, but they're all Godard.
Oh, you're talking about the guy who did Go-Go. Oh,
Go-Go Second Time
or
version.
Oshima, one yeah. of them, yeah.
And so he makes these like absolutely kind of abhorrent plots, but
they have an artistic.
They're all Godard. They're amazing.
But you need it to feel to like if you look at all the best horror has been always been the genre that could actually incorporate art house things mm-hmm. and do them like Suspiria or whatever, and do them in a way, but then make it also entertaining, yeah. which is what art house films aren't for most people, right? Entertaining.
Well, I think that you know, film school is really necessary in a lot of ways. It's where you go to fail and make mistakes, and it's where you make friends with like-minded people. But as you say, it's where you discover the roots of what it is you've loved. Like when I went to film school, I still loved Die Hard and yeah. The Crow. I remember when they did an interview to see if they were going to take you, and it was a very artsy film school. There are some film schools that are like training people to be little Spielbergs. This was not that.
Yeah.
These guys hated anything mainstream. It was and so when I did the interview, they were like, so what sort of movies have you seen that are a little bit different, you know, something that maybe – and I was like, oh, Pulp Fiction. And they all started laughing. All the they were all laughing at me. And they – you know, it's where you go to discover what influences Pulp Fiction,
right.
you know.
Right.
And I think you're right when you say it's kind of necessary. But I don't know, do you guys find that the movies you have to watch at film school – have you found that you've continued to watch those movies, or have you just gone back to watching Die Hard?
I mean, and I still respect them. Like, I remember my last year of film school, I had to watch this film that Elric's seen called Taste of Cherry, which was about a guy driving around a dirt pile trying to find someone to kill him
in Iran. Well, they
in
can't,
Iran.
You're not allowed to commit suicide in Iran. It's against the religion, so you'll go to hell.
Right.
So he drives around going, will somebody put me out of my misery.
For 2 hours.
I live in Iran.
It's the most bleak movie, and it ends, I won't say how it ends, but it's a bleak movie. And even though that I despised watching it at the time, and I was just like, this is so boring, I have found myself referencing shots from that thing more than I would have expected. So,
well, I mean, yeah. if you love movies, sometimes you can be surprised by them too, you know?
Like, yeah. Well, you have to. Sometimes you need to hit the reset button,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
You kind of like recalibrate your viewing experience and go, okay, you know what? I can do without Cameron this weekend. I don't know. Like film noir was the big thing in my film school. Like I took a film history class and I was like, ooh, I just like soaked up the film noir stuff because it was just adjacent to, you know, dark kind of genres and stuff like that, you know, watching I'm blanking on the name, but watching What's-His-Face like push somebody down, an old lady down the stairs in a wheelchair. I was just like, yeah, that's great. But you
I wish
that.
I went to your film school.
Yeah.
Like, because I think it's funny. There's a real scale of, for lack of a better expression, artsiness.
Yeah.
Like, I have friends that I went to high school with who would think that Traffic was super artsy and slow. Yeah, like, yeah, man, yeah, that movie's slow.
Right.
Like, film noir, way too mainstream for the school I went to. And now as I'm telling this story, I'm realizing James and I didn't actually go to a film school. It was an art school.
Yeah.
It had a
yeah.
film component. But when I say when there's a scale, you know, films like Moonlight, which I just saw last night, yeah. which I loved, to me that is so watchable, so compelling. When I say artsy films at film school, I'm talking like we once watched a movie that was an hour and a half of just someone lying on a table naked and there was a fly sort of landing on them.
Yeah.
Like endurance tests. They're not actually movies. They're experiments.
Yeah. Those give me anxiety attacks. Like I have problems watching movies like that because I'm like, just somebody do throw a pie, do something. I can't handle
it. Yeah, my question becomes is who is making this and for whom? I think it's more of an art experiment than it is a movie.
I actually remember that one, Amer, when that film came out. Amer,
I like that one.
No, but I remember thinking when I watched it, if that wasn't an art gallery, that would have been the coolest thing I ever would have stumbled upon.
Absolutely.
But on screen, I want more narrative. So, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think Warhol and people like that are a big reason those things were being done. These endurance test films, 24 hours of the skyscraper.
Yeah, those Warhol films, you can't think of them in the same terms that you think of narrative films in.
Yeah.
But we had to watch them all.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty
We had to stuff. Sit in a room, and I was just like, after about 20 minutes, you're like, I mean, I don't think I've watched anything like that since film school. I've never sat down and been like, I feel a great need to watch one of those two-hour Warhol movies that's a shot of a building. But, you know, I went to a museum in New York recently, and there was a film that blew my mind. It was a shot of it was an art installation. It was a shot of people looking at September 11th, the day after it happened. You never saw the destruction. It was just the faces of the people looking, and the artist had really slowed their faces down. And as the soundtrack, she recorded the national anthem that was sung at the first Yankees game after September 11th, and she slowed that right down. You couldn't even recognize it. It was like, and the watching it was so haunting. People's faces, you never saw what they were looking at, and it was super close up. Essentially, it was just an art installation, but it was so compelling that I stood there for like half an hour just staring at it.
Well, I think it's interesting. I think, I don't know if it was the same at your film school, but those kinds of films, they put everybody in a different classification. Like I rejected that. I was like, I don't want to see this Kenneth Anger weird biker experimental piece. Like I want to watch a film noir movie. So you had dividing lines drawn because the people who did like the experimental stuff went on to be DPs or they went on to do art installations or more fine art stuff because they realized I don't want to channel my inner artist and do mainstream movie making and entertainment. I want to just do art. Meanwhile, another faction of us just went, bye, we want to make Close Encounters, you know.
And that's definitely not all film schools because I have to confess, like my undergrad film school, the main professor actually wrote the book on horror films. It's called The Horror Film by Stephen Prince. Most of you guys probably have it on your shelf somewhere. And then I picked my master's school because of someone there had written a book on Buffy the Vampire Slayer that I was really into. And I was like, oh, that's where she teaches? I'm applying to grad school there. And that's where I went.
Becca's decisions.
I did not go to film school at all. But I had a really bitchin' dude with a mohawk at the video store at the corner that let me take whatever I wanted. So that was my film education.
That's a great film school.
That's totally like the Quentin Tarantino. I didn't go to film school. Well, I went to film.
I had a similar professor to you. We did have to watch all the Warhol movies that were torturous. But for the second 2 years of film school, I was there for 3 years. For the second 2 years, our professor was this guy, Philip Brophy, who actually made an Australian horror film that – if anyone would have seen, it would be the people at this table. It's called Body Melt.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, of course. That's
Body
like
it was kind
melt.
Of a it was kind of a diet Peter Jackson.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah,
not as good as Brain Dead or.
But it had a cool setup with the pills. I remember it was like a diet pill scam.
So that guy who directed that movie, he was James and I's film professor for our second 2 years of film school. And his idea of a great movie, he didn't want to know about Citizen Kane. He didn't want to know about Last Year in Marienbad or Hidden Fortress. We watched, let me try and think. We watched when I say watched, studied for a month. We spent a month studying I Spit on Your Grave.
Oh, amazing.
We spent a month studying Assault on Precinct 13. And so he was so artsy that he actually came full circle and was like, no, I see the art in Garbage Pail Kids.
Yeah.
And so he was into like trash art, but he would never approach it. He would never go and see Evil Dead for the sheer thrill of it. Like he went and saw it and studied it the way an art historian studies the Mona Lisa. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like.
Because I was going to say, I mean, I had Roy Frumkes as my screenwriting editing teacher.
Oh, really?
He was because from Street Trash. Yeah. And he was his whole thing. He showed us Assault on Precinct 13 as well. And then he showed us some weird.
Stephen Prince at my school showed us Assault on Precinct 13.
Yeah. So there's always one in the film school. There's always one outlaw. You know.
Yeah.
It's like, and apparently, you have to see Assault on Precinct 13. It's like a rite of passage in film school.
Yeah. But you never know what pushes you ahead. Like that's the thing. Like even the ones that bored the shit out of you, that's still like what you were saying. It still pushed you in the direction that you end up going in.
I agree.
So it is, it's a rite of passage all the way through.
It is. It's like you do that rite of passage and then you sort of come out the other side and you're like, this is definitively what I like now.
I wanted to ask kind of about what you and James kind of bonded over when you were in school together, because I have a memory, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I'm originally from the East Coast and years ago, I think it was around the time Saw 3 had come out and they were making Saw 4. But you and like a dozen people were guests at a Monster Mania convention. It was like the first big Saw thing.
Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Yeah, in Cherry Hill.
But
you told what to this day is one of the funniest stories I've ever heard at a convention, which was basically how you met James. And I'll have you tell it. But basically you kind of said, well, he was the one making all these art films, but he'd put a doll in it. Like everything just had a doll.
Oh, yeah. Well,
do you
that
remember
was,
this?
Yeah. So James and I met first day. We were both in the same year of film school. And what happened with us is we loved horror movies, but I think it just further to what we're saying about having to watch these Andy Warhol experimental films is what it ends up doing is throwing a little bit of a different color into your palette. So you go from being like a Hellraiser fan to all of a sudden going, oh, wait. The influence of this artsy film school is making me check out Dario Argento and Fulci. Like, as a suburban kid, there's no way I would have seen a Dario Argento film. But because I was surrounded by all these artsy types, so James and I, we got obsessed with Dario Argento and all this kind of Japanese horror. And then when we left film school, we were trying to think of an idea for a horror film, and James was just obsessed with creepy dolls. I think it came from his love of Dario Argento, but
So this has been going on for a long time.
Oh yeah.
Did he have him like in his dorm room? I have to ask.
He didn't.
A collection.
He did not, but he was always finding a way to work some sort of creepy puppet or doll into stuff. And I remember when we finally hit upon the idea for Saw, I was working on the script so hard, harder than I've ever worked on anything in my life until that point, which is not saying much. But I was really, and I came up with the scene where she has the jaw trap on her face. And I was so excited about it that I called James and pitched the whole scene to him. I'd promised him I wouldn't tell him a thing about it until I was done, but I couldn't help it. And I called him and I was like, so there's this girl and she wakes up and she's got a thing on her face and she has to get the key and the key is in this guy's stomach and she has to cut out the key and put it in. And James listened to it and I finished and I was like, what do you think? And he's like, it's good. And we put a creepy doll in it, it would be better. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, we've got to find a way to get a creepy doll in there. And I'm like, I was thinking like, what? How can we do that? But sure enough, we managed to shoehorn a creepy doll in there. And now that doll is the most popular actor in the Saw movies.
That's really funny.
Real diva. But yeah, that's basically that brings us up to Saw is, you know, after we finished film school, we were like, we've got to make a movie with our own money. Mm. Especially at that time, Australia didn't make horror films. New Zealand did.
Yeah, they just made one a year. Every year, there's one horror film made a year to balance the budget of the art stuff. That's how they did it.
I spent my whole 20s being envious of the New Zealand film scene. We were over there making like all these quirky dramedies with ABBA soundtracks. You guys were doing like Meet the Feebles and Brain Dead and Once
just
the Warriors.
Just before you guys would have had the big exploitation. The Brian Trenchard is like 10 years before, 20 years before.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Howling 3.
Exactly. Australia has a weird history with film. Like, in the 70s, they made the government just decided out of the blue to do this weird tax thing where if you put any money into a movie, you got 100% back. Not 50%, not 60%, 100%.
Oh, your money back.
It was called
you break even no matter
what.
Yeah,
it was – I think – I hope I'm not messing this story up. It was called a 10BA law, and what that led to is – tons and tons of these movies, these, you know, these crazy Ozploitation
movies. Which
are
terrific.
They're great. But that finished. They scrapped the tax law and then yeah. we went back to the system of government financing. So in Australia, if you want to make a movie for you Americans here, it's funded by the government. So it's actual taxpayer dollars. You don't have to pay it back. They give you – it's like an arts grant. So they give you $1 million. They say go and make a movie.
With cultural relevance. They always want cultural, you know, same with New Zealand. They want some sort of cultural thing, which puts a big –
well, the government – yeah, out, you know? The government is like, look, if you're going to spend taxpayer dollars yeah. and not pay them back, can you please contribute to Australian society yeah. somehow? But that term is so nebulous.
Because like in high school, the only thing I knew about Australia was what I learned in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And had there not been a lot of, you know
– you got to watch Walkabout. Walkabout is where it's
or
at.
Or Rabbit Proof Fence was another one. Right. Like my entire history of Australia comes from these movies.
From the movies. Yeah. I mean
– Razorback.
Razorback. Exactly. That's the way it is. And it's a lot of times when I tell people over here that the government puts money into movies in Australia, they're all freaked out. But it's actually the opposite. America is the only – well, one of very few countries in the world with a private film industry. I think like yeah. India, you know, Japan. Most countries in the world, if you watch a movie, the first credit that comes on the screen is like the Iceland Film Board presents. It's all government money.
Or the lottery.
Or the
I
UK
always see
Film
the lottery.
Lottery.
It's Irish Film Lottery.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's enough people here to sustain a private industry, but in most countries you're looking for the government to give you money to make a film. Yeah. And it's basically like making a film through the IRS. You have to fill out forms and cross all the T's, and it's kind of a bureaucratic process as opposed to here. It's like, you know, does having mean, lunch was, at the was, Ivy with somebody.
Yeah, was Saw something you guys tried to make in Australia first? Or
I
don't know this part.
We actually didn't. It's an interesting story. We wrote the script and we sort of tried to shop it around to the government, but they were so anti – they just weren't making that type of movie. And so my manager at the time, who's still my manager, she said, we've got to take this over to the US. And sure enough, we made the film over here. And it's amazing the amount of people who work for the Australian government, for the funding bodies, who have said to me in the ensuing years, like, oh, God, we really missed the boat on Saw. We've got to encourage horror filmmakers to stay here because we just left. We just flew the coop yeah. straight away and came here. You know, there was no – and they're starting to make more horror films in Australia, which is good. You know, Wolf Creek and everything. It's good.
More Wolf Creeks.
Yeah. But it wasn't like that, especially yeah, yeah. in the 90s. I mean, there was nothing.
Body Melt.
Yeah, there was
Body
Melt.
Was, I think, 93?
Yeah.
Am I around
so
there?
Yeah, it's yeah. 92, 93. I just remember the title. I was like, Body Melt.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a pretty cool title.
It's so day-glow. What?
Yeah, yeah.
The film's
super
not
day-glow,
great.
Yeah.
The film's not great.
No.
Just to give a little bit of context regarding – what the success of the first Saw brought to you. You wrote a really excellent blog on your personal blog about writing Dead Silence.
Yeah.
Which is very, very
creepy
candid.
Yeah.
About kind of just suddenly having the success and then kind of like, I don't really have a strong enough idea, but I guess I could make something out of it because they just wanted something so quickly. So,
yeah.
I mean, how long did Saw take to make, and was it kind of, did it feel like an overnight thing where now all of a sudden, like, you're making a movie for Universal Pictures and kind of like, oh shit, all right, what are we doing here?
It felt like an overnight thing right at the end. It's like the old saying of like, you work 10 years to be an overnight success. Like it took me a year to write the script. It took me a long time. I'd never written a feature length script before. And it just took me a long time. I had a full-time job. And then it took James and I another year before we got over here. And then when we got to the US, everything seemed to happen very quickly. Mm-hmm. Like we had a meeting and then 2 months later we were shooting the film. And then so we went to Sundance in January of 2004 and the movie didn't come out until October. So we had 10 months of this pre-social media hype. It was all message boards, which is really mm-hmm. weird to think of now, but it was like bloody disgusting.com message boards. And like there was sort of these rumors bubbling out there like, has anyone heard of this movie Saw? And it sort of built up over 10 months. And I remember right before it came out, we went to the Toronto Film Festival and they were screening it in the midnight section. And we flew over from Australia for the big Toronto premiere. And there was a line around the block at the theater at the midnight screening. And we were like, wow, I can't believe there's this many people here to watch this movie. And the publicist was like, that's the people waiting for spare tickets.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Like, everyone who's seeing the movie is already in the theater. Oh, wow. So that was like the craziest night of our lives. Like, they took us into the theater through the back entrance. It was like Goodfellas, you know, down yeah. through the bowels of this theater. And we could hear like 1,500 people, like, you know, like with their feet on the. And we were like, what is happening? Because we'd been in Australia the whole time. You know, every now and again we'd see something on a message board saying, oh, yeah, my cousin's cousin saw this movie at Sundance called Saw. He says it's good. So we thought there'd be 10 people in the theater. Yeah. So there was a bit of a disconnect as to why the room was packed. I guess we underestimated the power of yeah. word of mouth and message boards, and that community, the horror community in the US and everything is so strong that you can get that much hype. So then after that, we did Dead Silence, and that was like a big come down. Yeah, that was I don't know. It's a long story, but it was we weren't ready to pitch. I think I was too young and stupid to know that I could just say, all right, everyone just take a break. I'll come back to you when I have an idea. But we had a lot of people pressuring us, saying, like, agents and producers saying, like, you guys need to get your next thing cooking. And instead of saying no, go away, I was like, okay. Sure. And I was listening to everyone's advice around me. And so we ended up going into Universal and pitching this movie. And they were like, we love that. What a great idea. What, Chad, don't you love ventriloquist dolls? I know I do. And now in hindsight, I realize that, and I've done this meeting many times, what I realize now and didn't know then is that these movie studios are like giant, like, whale sharks that just keep their mouth open. And they swim very slowly and they scoop up everything. Anything that's new, anything that's having their little 15-minute flash in the pan, they scoop it up and they see what happens. They're just grabbing at stuff. So we could have gone into that office and gone, okay, it's about a bowling ball and the camera doesn't move. It's just a shot of a bowling ball for 2 hours, and they would have been like, I love bowling.
Yeah.
This connects. Doesn't it? Like, they were just buying the idea of us, but I was so young and dumb and naive that I thought they really did love it. And, you know, I went back to Australia and tried to write this movie, and it was a terrible experience, and it just kept getting rewritten, and I just kind of learnt all the lessons that you need to learn on that one movie.
Now, right. Was the studio really active throughout the whole process, like giving you notes on everything you were going? Okay.
When we pitched them the idea and they said, we love this. And then when we turned in the first draft, they were like, what is this shit? Yeah. And then it took like a year of rewriting, and they brought in some other guy to do a rewrite, and then they didn't like his rewrite, so they brought me back in, and it just kept going on and on and on.
Yeah, well, I'll post a link to your blog because you go into detail over the whole thing.
Yeah.
And which I think is really –
but it was my fault for writing a bad script. If I could go back in time, I would say I'm not ready. But
can you be objective about the movie at all? Because, I mean, my memory is I dig it.
Yeah, the weird thing
about Dead Silence is we do get a lot of people saying to us, like, I love that movie.
Yeah.
I think there's a few things going on. For me, there is a big contrarian streak in the fan community. Yeah. You know, anything that is
–
just check the comments section. Anything that's popular, like Saw, is kind of trashed. And then anything that's like some undiscovered VHS gem is like, well, this is the shit. So James and I have definitely felt the effects of that contrarian thing with Dead Silence, because we get the most love we get about anything is Dead Silence. I still am traumatized by the memory of making it, and I don't like it, but there are things in it that I think are really good, like weird stuff, and that I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool that I could see the germ of something that could have been good. We wanted it to be like Mario Bava. We were really influenced by A Drop of Water, you know, that section from that movie, and Dead of Night. I feel like if we could make that movie again today, it would be fucking great.
Yeah. Annabelle. Annabelle.
What did you do for your relationship with James at the time? I mean, like, you guys had just experienced the Saw, you know, phenomenon. Mm. When you were going through the studio system doing this, what did you guys, you know, have your, you know, static, or, you know, how did you guys come out the other side, you know?
And simultaneously, because the Saw movies at that point were coming out one a year.
Yeah,
so you guys
are
doing this, pitching to studios, And you ended up writing the first couple of Saw sequels. So was that happening simultaneously?
Yeah, yeah. I remember.
There's
I
a lot. It's a lot to a friendship.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know.
Yeah, I think James and I, we didn't have like fights during Dead Silence, but I think it wore us both down a lot. And especially when James went off to direct it, I think he was really worn down by it. I remember writing in this crappy apartment we were in LA. I remember writing Saw 2 and Dead Silence at the same time, which was not ideal to be. But we came through it okay. It was sort of our trial by fire where we were like, whoa, we got all the scars. And I think James went to movie jail for a while. It was funny how when I look back at Dead Silence now, it was like, you know, God or whatever creature up there runs the universe looked over and was like, yeah, you had fun with that Saw movie, didn't you? Really blessed. Now I'm going to dump all the problems at once on you. And it was like, so the movie didn't do well and it was all this stuff that was, all the problems that people talk about when they work in Hollywood kind of happened. And then James did Death Sentence next and that didn't do well. So the biggest thing I draw from it was it was a real lesson in humility. Like when you make a film like Saw and it goes to a festival, you do this 15 minutes of fame, you know, you do a victory lap around town and everybody wants to know you. And if you're naive like we were, you really believe it. So when someone pats you on the back at a party and is like, love your work, instead of today, I'd be like, great. But back then I was like, really? Oh, wow, this guy loves my work. How good's that? And Dead Silence was a lesson that it can all be taken away like that. It all literally, we went from being the new kids on the block. I was Donnie, he was Jordan. we went from being the, for lack of a better term, and I hate this word, the hottest things around. Everyone wanted to talk to us, to the phone. Not like no one wanted to know us. I realized how quickly that can happen. It's so fickle. And then when James did Death Sentence, which I did not write, but he really, it was like two strikes, kid, sorry. And we spent a lot of years after Death Sentence trying to get something happening and it just wouldn't happen. And finally we were so frustrated that we said, let's do another independent like Saw, and we did Insidious, which was made for, I think, less money than Saw. Mm-hmm. So Insidious was really us saying like, we've got to get back to our roots. Otherwise we're just going to tread water in this weird Hollywood studio world for the next 10 years. And I've seen that happen to people. They just sort of spend 10 years like, and then, you know, so that was it.
I'm just sorry, this is probably naive, but I don't actually know what was the reason for not as a team doing Saw 2. Was it never offered at the time or was it just...
You wanted something
Yeah,
different?
Was it that you wanted to do something else first?
No, the producers offered James and I to write and direct Saw 2 the Monday after the first one came out. It was such a weird phone call because it was like, congratulations, guys, let's do it again. It was like asking a woman who's just given birth what she wants her next kid to be named. And we were like, well, can't we just – and they were like, we need to get cracking. And we said – James said no. He was like, I really don't want to direct a sequel. And I was like, maybe. And I ended up writing it. So I guess James, he just didn't want to do a sequel. I think if that happened today, he would do it. But at the time, he – had delusions of grandeur. He just didn't want to do a sequel.
Repeat himself straight away. Mm-hmm. And it could have been the right move, you know.
And I was burnt out after Saw 3. They came back to me and said, do you want to write Saw 4 and 5 and 6? And I was like, I'm just done with this. That I don't really have anything more to offer, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was it.
You guys just didn't want to be a Bowsman.
Wow.
Hey, he got the next three.
We love Darren.
I was going to say, what's a good testament to your career, what you guys did is – you talk about, you know, we've seen so many of those people who do a big horror, you know, do a big film and then maybe strike out in the next one and then they kind of just, they just float and you don't, and like it's to the filmmakers out there, it's like what you have to do is just grab things by the balls and go make something. You know, you guys did that. You were just like, you know what? Forget it. We don't need a budget. We have an idea. We have a script. Let's go make Insidious, you know? Absolutely. Like you just have to go and make something. You can't wait for the opportunity to come to you because, you know.
Exactly.
You're just going to float. That's it. There's a lot out here. There's a lot of that out here.
And we had to float for a while. We were in the wilderness for a few years before we finally had that exact moment that you just said. It had to get to the point of frustration where we were like, fuck this, let's do it.
Do you remember the moment? Like when that moment happened where you were just like...
Yes, I do. There's two things that happen at the same time. One is I had written a film for James called X-Ray, which to this day I think it's a pretty cool script. It's like a guy who someone tries to kill him and he wakes up in hospital with face blindness, with the brain damage, yeah. So he can't recognize anybody. So then, of course, the killer comes back to finish the job. Someone told me that they pretty much made that movie with Mila Jovovich.
Yeah.
So, but X-Ray was pre the Mila Jovovich yeah. movie. We couldn't get that off the ground. It was really weird. It was like no one wanted to make it. And then simultaneously, James was going to do Castlevania.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
With Nicolas Cage.
What?
And, wow. And I remember I was in Santa Monica for one reason or the other. I think it was Christmas time or whatever. I'm like wandering around in a day's Christmas shopping and the phone rang and it was like James. And he was like, you know, Castlevania's fallen apart. I just got a phone call saying it's not happening. The film's not happening. And nobody's going to make X-Ray. That's not happening. Who are we kidding? Like, it's just not going anywhere. Let's just fucking go make a movie.
Yeah.
As you said, we don't need to do it with a studio. We don't need to do it with a ton of money. Let's just do what we did with Saw again. And I went home, and over that Christmas break, I wrote the first draft of Insidious. So I think you're right when you say, you know, if you find yourself treading water, just remember that what you love is making movies. It doesn't have to be like the bells and whistles, like studios and stuff. They're not really necessary. You know, if you can think of a really contained idea, you can get it done, you know, and, you know, we had to come to that realization. Luckily, Insidious was a success. If it hadn't have been, I don't know what we'd be doing. Like, I'd probably be back in Australia.
Wow.
Now, did any of the, any kernel of the idea of Insidious exist prior to you guys having to go, oh, we got to create a low-budget film?
Yeah.
Or did you just sit down that weekend?
No, actually, we had that idea back when we were brainstorming to come up with the idea for Saw. Mm. So what happened with Saw is James and I finished film school. We kind of kicked around for a year or so, and then we were like, we've got to come up with a movie, and we've got to do something that we can all set in one room with two actors. We were really influenced by Pi and mm-hmm. just – it seemed to be around that time in the late 90s when these high-profile independent films like Pi and The Blair Witch Project were coming out. And so we spent months and months trying to come up with an idea that could all be set in one room. It's harder than you think. You know, you try and come up with a really interesting plot set in one room. Mm. And I remember the only idea I can remember that went to the scrap pile was I had an idea that it was an elevator gets stuck. And it's like five people in an elevator and one of them's a killer.
And somebody made it.
Somebody made that movie.
Yeah, it's been made.
So this was like 2000 or 2001. So we just kept trying. And one of the ideas we came up with was about a guy who, when he sleeps at night, his soul leaves his body. And we came really close to saying, this is the one. We were both like, I think there's something with this idea. And then we had the idea for Saw. And we were like, no, this is the one. But we never really forgot that idea. So it was always filed away, you know, for years, ready to go. You can never throw your ideas out because you always come back to them.
Keep that drawer. That drawer stocked with ideas, you know, because you never know. I mean, like we even say that here, you know, it's just when filmmakers come in, you've heard the pitch before, I'm sure. It's like, so what do you have in your drawer that's just like maybe 5 years old? You never know because it's like whatever that – you know, regardless of fads of what's going on, you know, that idea could possibly kick off something else, like a new movement. You never know.
It's all timing, right? Absolutely. Like maybe that idea 5 years ago didn't work, but now all of a sudden there's something. I find when I go back to any material that I'm working on, like with a little hindsight, all of a sudden you look at it like, oh, I know where this can go. Like I just out of nowhere, like where one idea didn't work. And then 2 years later, you look at it again. You're like, oh, I know exactly how this could end. Now, all of a sudden, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know what the problem that I find is? Tell me if you guys experience this, is I find that as soon as you have an idea, it's a race against time for the zeitgeist to catch up to it. And sometimes you beat it, and sometimes you're like sitting there and some friend of yours emails you an article in Variety like, oh, here's your movie.
Yeah.
It happens to me all the time. I'm like, shit.
I almost feel like when you say it out loud for the first time, it's out there. And somebody else heard it.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're going to make that movie too.
I really do feel like that.
I did have a trippy dippy friend that said that, you know, like
Yeah. You're competing Deep Impact and Armageddon at the same time.
But you know,
similar movies.
I think Ghost of Mars and
There's a scientific explanation for it. I mean, beyond just like, oh, the, you know, it's like, I really do think that human brains, people who are interested in this stuff, they kind of evolve at the same rate. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing the same things. And it's no accident that all of a sudden there's five possession movies or it happens all the time.
Yeah, I think that it's always social cues playing into it too, things that are in the news. And so all of these things interpret similarly in people. And then you end up with, like, you know, the same movie about repossessing organs or things like that. Or volcanoes.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to talk about the movie in Australia. I have one script that I've written that I wrote a few years ago. And when I wrote it, AI and all this stuff was just not on the radar. And in the years that it's taken me to work on this film, all of a sudden you have all this stuff like Westworld out there. So it's really something you need to be careful of. You really have to be aware that that the world can catch up to your idea. You know,
sure. How good a judge are you of when you guys have landed, not from other people, but of yourself? Because I remember, actually I met you guys really briefly with a friend of mine, Stacey Lane Wilson, at the Insidious premiere at the Magic House. It was like the press day.
Yeah, that's right.
And I remember meeting you guys and I don't know if I'd seen it yet, but when I saw it, I was actually blown away. Like, I think it was the first film in a while that had actually blown me away because of the level of imagination with it versus, you know, straight torture horror that was so popular at the time because of you guys. also, reinventing again. But like Insidious was so much a throwback to, you know, the stuff we all loved in the 80s. It was a pure imagination fantasy. How good a judge are you when you guys finish that to go, oh no, this is really special? Or do you have to wait to see what the audience did for your own work? I'm just curious.
I think you have to wait for the audience to decide, because a lot of times what the audience thinks of the film is not up to you. And it's also true that history judges your films differently. Like, for instance, a lot of people have said to us over the years, like, well, obviously with Saw, you were very influenced by, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay and this. Yeah. And James and I always look at each other like, the first draft of this movie was written in 2000, like before September 11th. Like, for us to be influenced by those events, we would have had to have written the movie 2 months before it came out. Like, it's like
Cronenberg and AIDS. He was pre Cronenberg,
right?
You know, these movies before, but everyone's like, oh, but you're predicting it.
It's everybody thinks it's just allegory.
Yeah, you know.
And it's sort of proof that the world ends up taking your product and filtering it through their own views. Yeah. So there's this entirely different viewpoint about Saw and what it's really about that I actually am happy to run with. I certainly wouldn't say to someone, you're wrong, because, you know, someone's interpretation of something should be kept. So I think you just have to just make it and then release it like a dove. And literally, if you're lucky, people will see it. That's the first hurdle you have. And then the next hurdle is, once they've seen it, do they like it? And then the next hurdle is, does it have any lasting power? I mean, it's funny. Ever since I became an actual filmmaker, I have so much more respect for films. I was such a judgmental. I thought everything was terrible. I judged all these bad movies. Now I realize how hard it is to make a film. And I go a lot easier on films now, because even if I watch a movie that's bad, I'm like, respect.
You did that.
You did it.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough, man.
It's like,
it's so
I'm impressed that films get made.
Yeah, at all.
At all.
It's a miracle.
Yeah.
And
it's
then
a miracle,
I mean, you sit there, you watch Police Academy 5 or whatever. somebody, a grip and a gaffer and a camera person worked hard to make that film a reality.
To take them to Moscow.
Was 5
that's probably six.
Moscow.
Probably
and you know that they endured their own set of notes. Like, probably copious
I'm
amounts
fairly
of studio
sure 5
notes.
Was Miami,
yeah, 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 Miami.
And it does make me disdainful of the armchair criticism that Twitter and social media has created when there's this army of people out there saying, this is terrible, that shit, that's crap. It's sort of like, when you're on the other side of the trenches, you're like, man, it's just so hard to even make a film, let alone a good one. Like, you got to go easier on this stuff, you know, whatever. I mean, that's just – I guess they would say, well, just make better films or whatever. But it's tough. It's real tough to make
Well, I think the cool twist of Insidious, because we are also talking about haunted houses, is the idea – what I love about it is the idea of a person being haunted. You know what I mean? It's not the house. I think that's the thing that opens up – because the other movie that – a movie I love that never really gets talked about, it's, there's not a good release, is The Haunting of Julia.
Oh,
it's called
that's
Full Circle.
So good.
And that's the only other movie I can think of that kind of takes that. Rather than saying it's a possession film, it really is more like the person's going to start haunting you versus just the house. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
I think that to me was what made Insidious really stand apart and where you could go with it, that it was kind of unlimited the directions you could take it.
That's what we loved about it too. We loved the idea that astral projection had never really been messed around with in a horror film before. It's kind of a concept that's kind of ripe to be horrorized, but no one had really done it. And there's always got to be something that, for James and I, there has to be one thing about it that we feel like hasn't been done.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think we could be like, okay, let's just go, you know, although James made a great straight-up classic horror film with The Conjuring, but I think with Insidious, definitely the thing we loved was the astral projection angle.
Yeah, outside the box.
And I really loved the second one.
Oh, yeah.
Because I didn't see it theatrically. It's kind of crazy. It was one of those things I saw when it came out on Blu-ray, and I just revisited the first one, and I put it on, and just like... And it is a gimmick, but it's kind of like the Back to the Future 2 of horror movies.
We used to call it that on the set.
As soon as I knew that's what it was, I was so in. I was like, oh, I see.
We're seeing the
first movie from another angle. That's so cool.
I have mixed feelings about it because I, as you know, as the writer, I didn't love the script. And I'm affectionate about some parts of it. But then when I did the third one, which I directed, that was my first time directing anything. So you're so... you know, the weight of the world is on your shoulders because you're like, oh, am I going to screw this up? And so it's funny because speaking to what we're saying about perspectives and how a bunch of people work really hard on something and then the world shrugs, you know, I remember reading, actually Insidious 3 was fairly well reviewed, but there was one review, someone said, oh, you know, have you read the Variety review? And I said, no. And they said, don't. Which was I thought they were about to say, run out and read it now. It's glowing.
But as
soon as they said don't, I was like, well, now I have to at least read the opening line. And I didn't read the whole review, but the opening line was like a lazy, tossed off effort. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, you can say this film's terrible. You can say it's bad, but it couldn't be less lazy and tossed off. I treated that movie like it was Citizen Kane. Yeah. I agonized over every frame like it was Long Day's Journey into Night.
Yeah.
And you don't have to like it, but you can't say it was lazy and rushed. Oh, my God. I treated Insidious 3 like it was Lawrence of Arabia.
I want to make you feel good because I always like making them feel good. Biggest jump scare I've had probably bigger than Insidious 1 or 2 or any of the Conjurings.
Really?
Was a moment in 3. I think is it a bus that hits the old guy's way he's waving? And I'm sitting at a 3 o'clock session right after a teaching gig. I'm sitting there alone in a theater. There's hardly anyone there. And it happened and I jolted back and I felt embarrassed afterwards. I had such a big... jump. I can't remember the last time I jumped like that. So you orchestrated a perfect scare.
Oh, thank you.
So there's that.
The car crash scare.
And the old guy is actually, yeah. I think the cancer man's actually one of the scariest creations.
Oh, thank you.
Like,
I find that to be
quite a disturbing, because I also think even Conjuring, Conjuring 2 has something that feels a little bit similar. Obviously, you didn't write that one, but the old guy in there felt like he borrowed a little bit from that.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted him to be like the living embodiment of cancer.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, what's interesting about that, too, is it deviated into kind of like an urban environment. You know, it was in an apartment. It was in an apartment, like, you know, complex, as opposed to a house, like a suburban house. And I thought that it had through nice shades of, like, The Sentinel.
Yeah.
Which was nice. And also, it felt like even Insidious Chapter 2 had Sentinel vibes by just how bonkers it is.
I feel like James went full Dario Argento.
He went, yeah. If you had a cat with a birthday cap and it was like an old man's like birthday party, like, you know, in Insidious Chapter 2, I would have been like, okay, yeah, that lives in this world.
Yes.
Weird
stuff.
I
remember every 15 minutes turning to whoever I start with going, this part's Stepfather, Poltergeist 2. And it was like every 15 minutes it changed the movie.
So
but it was also fun, you know?
So turning to the kind of haunted house stuff, you know, I mean, what for you... You know, we've brought up a lot of titles and stuff like that, but what was the most influential for you? I mean, like, in terms of building your haunted house vocabulary.
So tell us about Poltergeist.
Exactly. Poltergeist.
We're all on that generation.
Poltergeist, it is the first haunted film that people of our generation see that really just – yeah. kind of blows you away. I mean, what's funny about the haunted house subgenre of horror is it's actually not a very big subgenre. There's not a lot of films in it. Once you start getting into it, you realize there's these sporadic movies from, you know, what, the 30s, 40s, like Your House on Haunted Hills. Then there's like, you know, Poltergeist and a couple, but it's not actually like you've got a ton of, like if you're a fan of slasher movies, you've got so much to choose from. Haunted house films aren't like that. And then of that small group, there's not that many that are effective. You can really whittle it down. Like, I think Poltergeist was obviously huge when I was young. I think The Others is probably one that really influenced me in the last few years.
Have you seen The Others recently?
I mean, I love The Others.
It's so well made. It holds up so well.
It's just such a beautiful movie.
So much dread in the detail from her, like, having to go from room to room and close each door behind her, you know, and all. We're talking about the Nicole Kidman movie.
Of course.
Yeah. The Spanish director.
Alejandro.
I mean, it's a beautiful. You know what? The biggest problem that. That The Others had was The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
If The Sixth Sense had never came out, The Others would have won Best Picture. It would be hailed today as the greatest masterpiece ever made. But it was like, can you imagine being the director of The Others and just going to the theater to watch The Sixth Sense and getting to the end and being like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I can't say that in a Spanish accent.
Well, it's like we were just talking about where once it's out in the world, everyone kind
of. All of a sudden there was.
I mean, timing is so funny. I saw a sneak preview of the Kevin Bacon movie, Stir of Echoes.
Which I love.
Before Sixth Sense. So I saw Stir of Echoes first as a sneak preview, and I'm like, this movie's amazing. And then Sixth Sense came out, and that was its own thing. And then Stir of Echoes came out way after it. And ended up being like, oh, the Sixth Sense ripoff movie, whatever.
Yeah, right.
But it's like, no, they were on that same idea at the same time.
I put Stir of Echoes in my scariest films of the 90s that I did last week.
You know, when I saw it not too long ago, it's a good movie.
It's
Stir of Echoes holds up.
The blue is gorgeous. Yeah. I highly recommend checking it out again.
It is a great
again.
Film. I mean, it's funny that the Haunted House films...
2000s.
And you can move beyond house. You could go to complexes and hotels.
Good haunted house movies are few and far between. I think the greatest for me is The Shining.
Yeah, it's the best.
The Shining is what's weird to me about The Shining is it's just so genuinely terrifying in this really abstract way. There's no jump scares or even there's not that much visceral that happens in the movie, but somehow it's terrifying. But what I love about the haunted house genre is if you're really into it, you're so starved for quality that you end up going deep cuts. So, like, my favorite haunted house films, aside from Poltergeist and The Shining, were like these straight-to-video made-for-TV movies like The Haunted, which is about the Smurl haunting, which is actually really super creepy. Have you seen this? It's got
the
Sally
haunted?
Kirkland in it. So this is a movie that was made for television for CBS in the 80s. It came out on VHS in Australia. But you could get it at one store. And believe me, James and I called all of them. There was one video store, shout out to High Street Video. We went there, we found a VHS copy, and it's genuinely, it's not like super well made. It's definitely
with Aldo Ray. Do you know?
I cannot remember.
Probably not Sally Kirkland's the psychiatrist in Trash Fire.
Sally Kirkland, very TV movie. It's based on a true story of this family, the Smurl family, who's house was like assaulting them and all this crazy stuff was happening. And actually the Warrens were brought in, like Ed and Lorraine Warren. And
it's a 1991 film.
91. It actually has some really creepy moments. There's one moment where the Sally Kirkland character, that they live with their grandparents and she's downstairs in the laundry. She's doing the washing up in the basement and she's walking back upstairs and her grandmother's voice, her character's name is Janet, and you hear her grandmother's voice say, "Janet." And she turns around and she's like, "Grandma?" She's like, "Mom?" And she goes back down the stairs and it's empty and she's like, "Hello?" And then she walks back up the stairs and it's like, "Janet?" And it's just so creepy. Like, there are moments in the movie that don't work, and then there are moments like that where you're like, "Holy shit, I have to drive home alone tonight."
Yeah.
Like, they just – it's – and so check out The Haunted. Another really good straight-to-video one – I got to say made for TV, because all these made for TV movies in America, they all came out on VHS in Australia. There's one called Don't Look Under the Bed that has a really –
it's the girl, she catches on fire.
I remember the last scene, she's standing at the end of the mother's bed. God, I just gave away the ending. But what is it? I swear it's called – I think it's called – it's either Don't Look Under the Bed or –
No. I know the one that you're talking about only because when Brian Collins came on our show a couple of years ago, he talked about this made-for-TV movie, and I have it sitting on my video shelf. I'll text my husband and make him go look to get the title.
Look, believe me, I'm Googling it right
now. So Brian Collins told me about this movie, and I couldn't find it, so I went on Trash Palace, and I got like a copy of it. And I have it. I haven't watched it yet, but I know if you flip over the back, there's a picture of a bed on fire. Don't go to sleep.
It could be Don't Go to Sleep.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
So this movie, right, it's not, it's kind of a sleepaway camp. 95% of the movie is not that great. The ending is so creepy to this movie. It's just a simple made-for-TV movie.
Dennis Weaver.
Is that the one?
Really?
Is this the right one? This might be different. Don't Go to Sleep.
That's it. No, that is it.
Yeah, okay. So Brian Collins, Don't Go to Sleep. I have a copy, guys.
All right, we're going to watch that. Group project.
Wait, and it's really good.
Valerie Harper?
It's in the same league as like Bad Ronald and... Let's talk about. Can we talk for a second about creepy made for TV movies from America?
Because
this is a subgenre of horror that I'm a big fan of,
and
it's really hard to track this stuff down if you're Australian. And even
here
now,
too.
It's like it's hard to find this stuff.
You know what sucks is because Bad Ronald's available on DVD, and that's one of my favorites. But Scream Factory, who does a lot of these releases of all these great horror things, they were going to start dabbling in these made for TV movies, and they put one out as a double bill. What was it? The Initiation of Sarah.
Another one.
Oh, wow.
And it just didn't sell.
Just didn't work. Mm-hmm.
So they're like, there's no market for it, even though fans want it, but nobody bought their one double bill of it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they would have continued to put some of these TV movies out.
Yeah, it's like, if I went to Amoeba and saw Don't Go to Sleep, I would snap it up.
Buy it right away.
But it's just, as you say, it's just not
And, you know, you hit on something. There. Isn't that the funny thing about horror movies? I think the reason, and we've said this on the show before, but as fans, we will watch anything if it's got that one thing. If it's got that one scare, that one cool ending, just something we've never experienced before, we will whittle through as much crap as possible to find that one title and be like, it's not very good, but the scare is so good.
It's like seeing that one shot in Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah, it makes the whole movie.
When you talk about that movie as a kid, you're actually just talking about that one shot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
And you know, there's a Spielberg made-for-TV movie called Something Evil that is pretty creepy. You should try and track that down.
Oh, you know what? Yeah.
Have you heard that?
He made it after Duel.
Yeah.
And it's like a haunted house. It's actually pretty effective.
Really? I think they had a print of it. They showed it once at the Cine Family as part
of... Oh, are you serious?
So that...
That would have been awesome to see that on the big screen.
Did Haunted House films ever, you know, actually scare you? Because I got to say, that's the only genre that can scare me. I can watch anything and not be at all affected. But when I'm alone at home, it would be a Haunted House film that would get... Even Paranormal Activity 2, I'd watch it and go, oh, it's okay.
100%.
But then as soon as it ends, I'm actually kind of creeped out because I live in a house and ghosts could be real. Like, I have no evidence telling me they're not real, and you know what I mean? So it's not like dinosaurs or masked killers. You know, there's something about it that
I agree with everything you just said. I think, for me, the haunted house subgenre is the scariest subgenre of horror.
Wow.
And, you know, slasher movies and stuff, I enjoy them, but haunted house movies always get me, and I think
within reason, I feel like grounded. If they're the more grounded they are, or you like feel like the Lutz family.
But for the reasons you're saying, though, I think it's because they're so relatable. Like when you're sitting on the couch watching a haunted house movie, when you turn it off, it doesn't end. It's like, oh, I live in a house,
and it intensifies all your actual senses, right? It ends, and suddenly you hear everything. You feel the creaks, and I've been in so many situations.
No matter what it is, I always think about it like right before, you know, you go to sleep and you hit all the lights and you just hear a noise. It could be anything, the house settling or whatever, and you're like, shit, what is that?
Haunted house movies. I mean, I definitely suspend belief while I'm watching them, but those aren't the ones that I think about afterwards. Like home invasion movies will fuck me up. Later on that night, I'm like, somebody could be right on that other side of that window. And weird enough, if alien abduction films are done well, those will mess me up because that's the one thing that I'm like, could be.
Mm. But then I watch something like The Entity and I go, imagine if the ghost really started to rape me. How fucking scary would that be? Not just because it's scary, but because no one would believe me. And I would be physically attacked by the entity, which is a horrifying
movie.
No
one's going to believe you, Elric.
I mean, obviously he wants to take a little piece
of
this.
Well, that's it. Well, that's an interesting thing. Let's discuss really quick. I mean, like the films that are isolated, it's the actual house. The house is the thing that's the evil thing.
Yeah, because even in like Poltergeist, it's the person.
The Poltergeist
comes that trend, and I always remember the old Dark House. Those movies always started with the fake outs, which were you inherited a house. You know, here's the keys, right. And somebody's there to scare you out of your inheritance. So it's a fake ghost story, right. Which would be cool if somebody comes and fakes you out and then they get haunted for real. I don't know if that's actually been done yet. I got to copyright that quickly.
Shining is the greatest of
they
those.
They just greenlit like 12 of
Shining,
them.
Shining, it's like the building itself is...
Amityville works to a degree, I think. I mean, it's a little dated now, but I mean, that was a movie that I remember... One Sunday afternoon, you know, one fall afternoon, my mom was doing like a little fall cleaning. All the windows were open. And I remember wandering by the TV just as the kids were playing out like by the windowsill. And the window crashed down on the kids' hands. Mm-hmm. And like I walked up to the window and I was just kind of like my own window. And I was like closing it very gently because I didn't want it to crash down. But it was...
Because it changes your every day.
It changes your every day. But it was also the house, you know? It was a house that was a thing.
See, with that film, they led with, well, in the film version, obviously, the real event, but they lead with the tragedy that happened in the house. Those where you don't know, they're built on a bit of a mystery. It's just a house. You don't know. You move in, things happen, and then you unravel the history.
Well, that it reminds me of a sort of underrated horror haunted house film Burnt Offerings.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so...
Best swimming pool scene in the history of cinema.
Yeah.
Something about Burnt Offerings that always got me.
Yeah, no, it's also quite surreal. You know, some of the dream and the limo and the, you know...
There was a little period of like underrated horror films in the kind of late 70s, early 80s, like Burnt Offerings, The Sentinel, The Changeling.
Yeah, the Changeling's actually emotionally one of the best, I think.
Yeah, you know...
With real actors. You know, they actually had stars like Oliver Reed and George C. Scott and these guys who brought their weight. They probably didn't want to do it. They probably manager forced them. But then they make something, you know, bigger and better.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Kind of interesting. Were there any, when you guys were, you know, when you were coming up with Insidious, were there any actual films that were also influencing that at the time besides astrology?
Well, the biggest thing that influenced us on Insidious were real-life ghost stories. Mm. We were always... you know, hungry to hear ghost stories. James and I have sort of collected all these ghost stories over the years from people we know, and some of them were like terrifying and we wanted to use them in a movie. So I would probably say that was our biggest influence. And then, you know, movie-wise, I mean, there's a bit of Carnival of Souls in there.
Absolutely.
There's a little bit of like Poltergeist and a lot of like David Lynch, like there's a certain thing that David Lynch does that only he can do. He can make the most monotonous, mundane thing, just a brightly lit diner in the middle of the day. He can make it really terrifying.
Yeah.
Just fill it with so much dread. He's got this thing that this alchemy that he's capable of that it mystifies me how he can do it.
And the 1950s vibe with the music, that's one place I do see that connection between Insidious. Yeah. You guys using the old songs and the, you know, creating something creepy out of something that should be a cheerful and sunny song, but instead it's Blue Velvet.
Yeah. You know,
or tip throw through the...
Yeah, even like that first half of Lost Highway, just using a lot of like darkness and like turning around and thinking that someone's lying there and it's somebody different. Like the first half of Lost Highway is one of the scariest movies ever made.
Terrifying.
I put that, I've been doing a series of like the scariest movies of each decade throughout the month of October, and I put that on one of my lists as like the scariest movie of this decade. And people argued with me in like the comments section saying it's not even a horror film. And I was like, that movie scared the crap out of me when I watched it.
It's a horror noir. But there's that moment where he looks over at his wife and she has the face of the mystery man, Robert Blake, and it's just awful, that moment. The bottom drops out. And
I thought about that movie for days afterwards.
Oh, yeah, it gets
and
to
I
you.
Can't say about that.
It gets to you. I mean, look, I just don't agree with these people who say that's not a horror film.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
A horror film is anything that scared or disturbed the hell out of you. Mm-hmm. Like, Under the Skin, to me, is a great horror film.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I couldn't stop thinking about that for days after I saw it. It disturbed me so much. And so I think that people put too narrow a box on this stuff about what is and what isn't a horror movie. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Lost Highway to me absolutely is a horror movie. It really is. It incorporates other genres too, like noir, but who really cares? I mean, who cares about genre? It's just like, did you like it? That's really the only question to answer. And Lost Highway scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
It's just so, it's just.
Even Mulholland Drive too.
Oh,
yeah.
Mulholland Drive's terrifying.
Yeah. Sequences of that terrifying. Are completely. And other parts would be grand comedy. It's amazing.
I think about
it's
Twin Peaks. Film. There are some episodes of Twin Peaks that like.
Terrifying.
That Bob, terrifying. That whole character.
Oh my God, I was scared to death of Bob.
Well, the ending of Kyle MacLachlan. Yeah. Just like, that's the scariest thing I've ever seen.
Actually, the movie Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me is so underrated.
It's so scary.
That movie is so scary. That scene where the woman comes up to her at the supermarket and says, you know, there's a man in your house. Yeah. All that stuff, you know, it's and so it's
that's always the beauty. That's always the beauty of Lynch, though. I mean, he's always able to like juggle multiple genres and strike that balance in a really great way, because you'd be watching some weird, you know, romance, Hollywood romance between these two women, and then all of a sudden just devolves into like pure nightmare fuel, you know. we were talking about earlier on the show is just kind of like a little insidery, you know, industry thing, you know, with what's-his-face in Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, yeah.
Darren Bousman. Every time we watch it, we're like, oh, there's Darren.
There's you. But it's the horror. He's tapping into the horror of his everyday. He doesn't care about your everyday. He was thinking back to, like, what did I feel? Oh, that Eraserhead is like, what I felt living in Philadelphia.
Right.
I felt like shit, and I felt like this, and there's a weird baby, and then my daughter's got clubfoot, you know, and puts it into a movie, and you go, oh, fuck.
Dude, that's what you're talking about is exactly the key to horror. Yeah. Like making a horror movie is, you know, tapping into your own personal expression, and you know, like Toby Hooper in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
Being surrounded by hundreds of like Christmas shoppers and going, oh, yeah, I want to grab that chainsaw and chop everybody down, you know? It's like, that's the thing. It's like, everybody is too busy. I'm going to get on a soapbox, but it's like everybody, you know, is too busy worrying about what everybody else is doing.
Yeah. Get off my lawn.
Just go make your own thing. What scares you? Go put that out there.
Yeah,
you know?
Your own voice. You had mentioned that you and James were influenced by real life ghost stories that people have told you. Have either of you ever had a supernatural experience? Because I deny that. Anytime I think, I'm like, nope, I didn't hear that noise. I don't want to be haunted. No.
So, right. I have not had an experience where I was like, oh my God, that was a ghost or that was supernatural. James has. He's had a couple, but I'm almost envious, you know, because I just think as scary as it would be to have an experience with a ghost, first of all, it's pretty exhilarating to be like, wow, there's life after death. I just saw something beyond our world.
It's the most optimistic subgenre.
Yeah,
exactly. It. Everyone talks about, horror is terrible, and you're like, actually, it's the closest to religion.
Yeah, we're all
establishing an afterlife, you know, people.
Yeah, exactly. So,
have you been convinced by, like, piggybacking on what he's asking, though, has any of these stories actually you gone, whoa, I believe you believe that, and somebody was so convincing in their telling, especially if they're not somebody who believes. I always find if somebody tells me, they go, I don't believe in ghosts, but this happened, I'm always 10 times more scared.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a skeptic. I'm not somebody – if somebody tells me a ghost story, I really want to believe it. And plus, a lot of people that don't have any reason to lie to me and frankly don't have the imagination to lie have told me ghost stories. Like my mother, she's not making up ghost stories. And for her to tell me something – it's pretty profound, because you're like, wow, this is my mum talking. I have had other skeptics say to me, like, look, the human mind is a pattern seeking machine. Of you know, I think that, you know, your mother wanted her father to appear in a you know, and so this person, the skeptic I'm talking about, he could reason anything away and talk about but I'm more the person that's really open to it. Yeah. You know, I'm never a skeptic.
And is James the same way, or is he more of even a believer?
Well, he's had actual experiences with ghosts, and so he's very much like, he's the opposite of a skeptic. He's like, this is real, this is happening, we're under attack. And I think, you know, it shows in our films, because we really, in the Insidious movies especially, and in The Conjuring for James, like, I think you have to believe in it for it to be effective. Yeah. You really do. You know, you have to believe in this stuff to make a scare scene work.
Now, are they all the stories you've heard? This is, I guess, how it relates to horror. Are they always negative? Because the idea of an afterlife or a ghost could also be positive. They don't really fit well into scary movies. But the idea that you'd see ghosts or entities, you know, and not be a negative thing, that this could be a positive thing. Now, many of the stories have that bent that you've heard.
Yeah, it kind of runs the gamut. I mean, even positive ghost stories, though, are kind of creepy to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like someone that I knew a long time ago, her daughter died in a car crash, and she said that she was sitting at home during the day. Her daughter was 21 when she died, and she was sitting at home and had just gotten the news that her daughter was gone. So you can imagine how traumatic and shocking it is. And she's sitting on her couch, and she said she looked up, and it was the middle of the day, and her daughter was standing at the back door just staring in at her with a big dog beside her. But dog was just sitting there, and then her daughter was just looking at her, and then she just walked away with the dog. And it's like not scary, but it just, you know, it gives me chills. There's something about it. So I guess these ghost stories don't necessarily have to be malevolent.
Yeah.
Someone doesn't have to get pushed down the stairs for them to really have an impact on you, you know?
Yeah, well, ghost tours are, if you ever do a ghost tour of a New Orleans or a Savannah, some of the places that have gone on these things, they usually say, you know, the reason ghosts versus people have just passed on, you never hear from again, they've gone to the afterlife, is because they weren't expecting death. It was a shock. It was a surprise. Someone came behind you, shot you, pushed you downstairs, did something, and it's a displaced entity in times. And I always thought of that as, if there's an angle to this, it always kind of rang true. Like, that would make sense. You're confused. You're between places or buried wrongly, incorrectly, if you believe in...
Well, the human body, you know, is filled with energy. We have electricity inside us, like, and energy doesn't die. So I think when our physical bodies die, you could point to the science of just the general human energy that we put out lingers in a space. And maybe, just maybe, that energy manifests itself as some sort of hallucination in the eyes of... If someone you love has just died in a room... And you're in that room, maybe their energy sort of transmits itself through, you know, through your retina as a figure, a person with a face and a mouth and eyes. I mean, you just don't know. But as I say, too many people have told me these stories for me to go, it's all rubbish.
When you certainly feel presence, and I don't mean ghosts, I mean physical presence of spaces, especially houses. If you go somewhere, say New Orleans, and often these are cities where the dead weren't buried in normal ways. So, you know, obviously buried above ground in New Orleans and Savannah. There are a lot of people during yellow fever just dumped into pits and then buried over and stuff.
Right.
So I always think it's funny that they tend to be the most haunted cities because there's some correlation. But if you've ever been, I remember going to a hotel once and go, oh, I don't even know what I believe, but I just felt like, oh, it feels oppressive. What is wrong with this place? And then somebody goes, oh, that's the most haunted hotel in XYZ. And you're like, oh, I can totally feel that. I don't know why. I can't put my finger on it. You know what I mean? Like you said, probably that some sort of energy. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
We're going to wind down in a minute or two. But I was just curious about, you know, now having been involved in a few successful franchises, kind of your surreal take on kind of the influence that they may have had on pop culture. You know, for example, you know, this month we're sponsored by Universal Halloween Horror Nights.
Of Hollywood.
And I've been to the year they did the Saw Maze. I've been to the year they did the Insidious Maze. Yeah. What's that like for you as a guy that sat there and wrote this material, and now all of a sudden there's this maze that every night thousands of people are just running through?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what's that experience like from your perspective?
Like trick-or-treaters dressed up like Jigsaw.
It's crazy. I mean, it's one of the good things about the whole experience is that I've never become jaded. I've never gotten used to anything. So when I go to the Universal Studios and see the Saw Maze or the Insidious Maze, it really trips me out. In no way am I flippant about it. Like, oh yeah, that's to be expected. It's like, I cannot believe it. and I just love it. Like, it's really amazing. We were saying before, making any film is really, really hard. And it is. To make a film that then goes on and has an impact on the culture where it's being name checked. I mean, Saw was referenced in South Park, The Simpsons, The Sopranos, any show that started with S, basically. I'm sure 6 Feet Under did something. That is a weird experience to see something you've sat in a room and worked on penetrate the pop culture lingua franca. Like all of a sudden someone on The Sopranos is like, you know, we got to make a movie like Saw. Because that basically puts Saw on the same level as Madonna or, you know, Breaking Bad. It's one of these things that people reference. You know, I'm not in any way a celebrity. I'd never get recognized, but Saw, the franchise, is a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you could say to a grandmother from the Midwest, Saw, and she'd probably be like, oh, is that that horror movie? Like it's sort of I never get over it. It's always weird to be like, wow, this has made an impact. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's great. I got kicked out of the saw maze when I went. I had to talk my way back in. I walked in.
You touched something, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I didn't know. First of all, we don't celebrate Halloween in Australia, which is a crime that I'm going to sue Australia for.
That's so concerned.
And I'd never been in a Halloween maze before. And I walked in. I didn't really know how they work. And my friend from Australia, who was even more of a neophyte than I was sort of wanting him to be scared. And I shoved him. I saw a pair. There was a pair of boots behind a curtain where these guys hide. And I pushed my friend through the curtain.
Oh.
And whoever was back there kind of ripped the curtain close. And the next thing I know, I'm walking through a room built to look like the bathroom in Saw. And there's an actor pretending to be me on the ground screaming at me like I was like, this is the most surreal hall of mirrors I've ever stepped into. It was so crazy. And all of a sudden there's this tap on my shoulder and I turn around and there's this like 5-foot guy who looked an awfully lot like Michael Cera holding a clipboard and he was like, come with me, sir. I thought I'd won some grand prize. Like, okay, I get it. This is like Stephen King doing The Shining maze. And before I know it, we're out in the alleyway. I'm like, what's happening? And he's like, you have to leave, sir. And I'm like, what do you mean leave? And he's like, you cannot interfere with the performers. You've been asked to leave. We're very strict about it. I apologize, but you're going to have to go. And I was just staring at him. I was in that maze 10 seconds. And I said, I don't know how to tell you this, but that's my maze.
Yeah.
I wrote that film. And he's like, I understand, sir. Let's go. And I was like, no, you don't understand. I really did write that film. You have to let me do this maze. And he was like, eventually I talked my way back in, but that was kind of humiliating. But
that's the one time you used your car.
I was like, listen.
But he didn't even listen the first few times.
That's fantastic.
That
that's
ain't a maze. That's
what I'm doing next time I get thrown out of a maze because it's going to happen now. I wrote this movie.
Stinkiest maze I'd ever been through. Maze almost cost me a date because I took her through and she was like, I'm going to vomit. Yeah. I was like, no, please don't. And she's like, I can't believe I'm going through this. I'm like, keep going.
Well, we found out from when we had Mr. Murney on that they probably used vomit scent.
Really? You know, I think the Exorcist maze that they just did.
Oh, that one
stinkiest.
Was foul.
It was bad, especially in that final room where her head's spinning around. Yeah. I don't know what they were using.
No, the Texas Chainsaw one did me in where I thought I was going to get sick during
There's one room that smells like there's a corpse in it. I don't know what a corpse smells like.
So do they actually use, they get bottled scents, liquid, and they spray it out into the room.
It's like, it's like, there's like a little fumigator.
I think he described it more as like a vaporizer, I'll call it.
Wow, it's really interesting.
Pretty amazing.
I do remember that the saw maze was stinky.
It was. Yeah. It was very potent.
I always wonder if the actors work in that like the whole time. Do they like leave smelling that corpse smell? Like, is it all over them?
I think he's
like, I used to have a friend who worked at KFC, and even after he showered, he still smelled like KFC. Like, I wonder if that's
biscuits.
How it...
It's like you chew on his skin a little.
Yeah. If you work in that corpse room, you deserve a raise.
Yeah. I'm going to assume you can't tell us much about it, but can you give us a little hint as to next year's spec maze, the specs maze?
Specs maze?
Just give me a little taster of the specs maze.
Is there a specs maze?
Oh, dropping the information bomb today.
I have no idea.
What are you talking about?
Specs for a Schoolies maze is going to be
what? Are you talking about?
I think they need to do a Cooties maze.
Cooties, that would be a great one,
That
actually.
Sounds great. There'd be a lot of kid actors, though. There's some legal issues there.
But I'm waiting for more specs crossover in the movies. You know, we've pitched them, you know, over here on the
strangely,
you know
what? No one's buying.
On cue, this is about the point that we start wrapping up is when Elric starts pitching ideas.
Every week.
I always cross over.
He does crossover.
Wait, what was your mix
specs
from
versus Ghoulies?
No, it's going to be specs investigating the original Paranormal Activity movie. I wanted the timelines to come and you guys to come and Katie Featherston to be there. And that is a movie.
Go. Here we go. I like that.
I actually
and there we are.
You actually pitched something interesting.
He does it every week.
You don't say that. Don't
You said Specs versus Ghoulies.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it hit me. Why aren't they doing crossover movies with current characters fighting that short-lived subgenre of Gremlins ripoffs?
He's already pitched.
Critters versus Ghoulies.
Okay. Maze.
All right.
Look, Turk.
Munchies.
I was going to say, I wanted to do a quiz. Let's go deep cuts on post-Gremlins movies.
Right. Do you guys remember Fuzz Bucket, directed by Mick Garris?
Don't know Fuzz Bucket.
Okay, so wait, let's name them all. Okay, so you said Munchies. We've already said
Critters.
Get them on the table, yep.
A gnome named Norm?
What? That is a deep cut.
That is a deep cut. Okay. Yeah. You need to check out Fuzzbucket. That one, they're not like angry in that. Like Fuzzbucket was supposed to be a good guy. I think he was kind of like, but he looked more like a critter. So it was weird.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. There's a couple where maybe like they're not quite little creature movies, but they fall into the same category.
Yeah, just like weird little impy things.
Like does
Leprechaun? We didn't say troll. We didn't say troll.
Troll's a good one.
Can we count the little troll at the end of Cat's Eye, which has come up a lot lately?
Even though it's
what about like
Drew Barrymore?
Subspecies and the Subspecies. Gate had those little critters
in
it,
too. Yeah. The gate.
I mean, the pit has little critters in it, too.
I'm blanking on one. There's one. Yeah, it's a not the Willies.
Well, the Willies kind of. Boogans?
Boogans,
baby.
Bogans?
Wow. The Bogans.
Oh my God.
The Bogans.
Is that an Australian
heavy metalers?
No, it had a really good cover where it was a cabin in the woods that was being grasped by these green claws.
Because they were like little guys, right?
Yeah, they, they went underground and they came and got you.
I have no recollection.
We need to bring that subgenre back, man.
Universal's going to be stoked we ended on
that. Here's what you need to do. You need to do an entire show devoted for forgotten subgenres of horror.
Oh, yeah.
Like the post-Gremlins little creatures that ran for a while.
Yeah.
What else was
there? The thing
there?
In this genre, nothing's forgotten. Somebody's writing an article on it as you speak.
I'm writing this down right now. This is going to be an article by next week, forgotten subgenres.
All right. Well, we'll
I'm trying to think of some right now. Like
those will be our pitches for future episodes.
Yeah.
Well, as we go, what about Halloween? Because now that you do spend Halloween here, is there a Halloween film that you'd recommend for people to check out this Halloween, or something you'd like to watch around this time? Like everyone has different traditions for what they get into to set the mood.
Well, yeah. I mean, once you get past the obvious one, Okay. Essentially, for me, it's just about horror. So I wouldn't so much say a Halloween movie as I would. I would say I would always go back to that VHS era and watch something like, I think something like April Fool's Day or something that to me, that's my sweet spot for nostalgia is that those VHS movies that promised so much more on the cover than they delivered in the movie.
My goodness.
Happy birthday to me.
Oh, yeah. The covers from that era were insane.
Yeah.
Just such good and great taglines as well.
Boogans. That's a good way better. The cover's great.
Are we going April Fool's Day as your pick for your
Let's go.
Pick?
Yeah, sure. April Seems Fool's weird Day. To go April
All right,
Fool's
well, let's
Day
go around
Halloween.
The table. Go. I mean, this is our Halloween episode.
Oh my
so,
God.
Rob G, go.
We already wrote 31.
Yeah, we wrote 31 of them.
But if you had to watch one, the night before Halloween. Halloween 3 is still something that because. I don't know. That's the most fun one to think.
I just rewatched Halloween 3 and it is great. I'm going to say The Fog.
Yeah.
And over the years, my appreciation for that continues to grow. And it just feels very Halloween-y to me.
This year,
I don't know if it's set on Halloween, but it just feels like it.
Yeah.
I want horror comedies on Halloween night because it feels so much more fun to me. Like, it's not a night I want like crazy scares. It's something that I want like the Trick or Treat movie or like Shaun of the Dead or Severance. I want something that's more kind of light and airy.
I think this year I'm going to go with Bram Stoker's Dracula.
See, good that's one. Heavy. I like that's that. A heavy
I
movie.
I haven't seen that movie in so long, but it was when it first came out. I think that was my first. I remember when it came out, it was like, oh my God, I've never seen a horror film with this much conviction and this much grandeur, where it's just like, you've got all of these stars coming together for something big and epic and the director's out of his fucking mind and he's just doing all these things.
It's probably the most beautiful looking horror film that's ever been made.
You know, we're talking about film school. I remember breaking down the carriage sequence in that repeatedly in film school, the set and apparently
The rear projection.
Which is directions and how they built it on a loop. I remember like learning all about that.
I just remember the beast is having sex with the girl at the end. That's all I remember.
You know,
the
giant wolf. I'm gonna change my Halloween film. I'm gonna go Sleepy Hollow.
Nice.
Yeah, because that's a good one. Obviously the Johnny Depp version.
Yeah.
That is a really underrated comedy. That's so funny.
Yeah,
it's so funny.
But it's also scary. Like it did actually have genuine moments where
it's also very I remember reading something that Tim Burton had said when he was like, I'm just trying to make a Hammer movie. I've always wanted to make a Hammer movie. And that's he did it. He pulled it off.
And he even got Lee. That was one of the first times we saw Lee in a long time. Where we're like, Christopher Lee's in a movie now.
Yes,
I remember being blown away at the time. Yeah. Like, he's alive.
Yeah.
That is so cool. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Well, that was awesome.
Yeah, Lee, thank you so much for your
time. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. And happy Halloween, everybody out there.
Happy Halloween.
Thanks for listening.
We'll see you in the next month, whatever that is.